I'm getting ready to have to go get my glasses.
I didn't bring my cheat sheet with me. Oh. Good morning. Welcome to the June 20th meeting of the Chelan Public Utility District. Today is a study and a business session. This morning we do our study session. This afternoon our business session. We'd like to welcome everybody here. I don't see a lot of visitors in the audience, but we may have some at a later point. All of the commissioners are here. All of our regular staff are here. And at this time, I'd like to remind everybody that this meeting is being recorded. And if you wish to address any item on the agenda, please come up to the microphone at the table and state your name and address for the record. And we would appreciate so we can keep track. Also, at this time, I'd like to remind everybody, if your cell phone is in its on position, if you could turn it to vibrator off, we would appreciate it so we can conduct our business without cell phones. At this time, I'd like to start with a Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute being led by Keith Prescott.
I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, and good morning, everybody. Keith Truscott, Director of Natural Resources. First day of summer, thought it'd be fitting today to have a safety minute to help you keep safe if you're out doing work or play in the outdoors this time of year, and you would run across one of our local critters that run around. Rattlesnakes would be the topic for today. Rattlesnakes are subject to a lot of misinterpretation and misinformation. And the first thing I wanted to clear up was they're really not an aggressive critter as some people describe them. So, and the second thing is most people end up getting bit by a rattlesnake because they're trying to handle it or to kill it. Best thing you can do if you see one of these is just back up and let them be. They'll generally crawl off and find a place to hide out and be on their own. If you happen to be in your yard or an area where you've got your pets or there's kids out, you want to let folks know that there's a snake around. And if at all possible, try not to disturb and just let it be on its own. About 8,000 people a year get bit by a rattlesnake when they're out and about. Of those, on average, maybe 5 people die a year. Compare that to, on average, about 85 people die a year from a bee sting. So they're out there. Leave them alone, and they'll be happy, and you'll be happy. If you are doing work outside or you're hiking and stuff in an area where there's known snakes, and they like talus slopes, rocks. They like to lay under cover, piles of rocks or wood. Long pants, leather boots. Be careful where you put your hands and your feet. Keep an eye out for them. They do have the distinctive rattle, and they'll rattle. If they sense that you're in their area, if you hear that, just stop. Look around. If you see that snake, just slowly back up, and hopefully everything will turn out good. The piece I wanted to add to you is if you did happen to see a snake at PUD facilities somewhere, call the District Services Work Group, Greg Jones or Marilyn Fullerton, and they have some folks that can come help, you know, gather the snake up, take it to an area where it won't hurt itself or someone else. Good safety tip there. Last thing is, if you do happen to get bit by one of these, about 20% of the bites are dry. Don't try to guess if you're in that 20%. Go to the hospital as soon as you can. Try to keep your heart rate low because that blood flow will circulate the venom. Try to keep the bite below the heart. Don't do the Western cut and suck. That doesn't work. You just cut yourself worse and start bleeding more. Try to keep yourself calm. Don't use tourniquets. Don't use ice. Best thing is just quickly go to the hospital or call 911. Any questions?
So if you're hiking up in the hills and it's a long ways out, does that change your approach?
So if you're out in the hills, and depending on how far out you are and the location you have, you want to get out and you want to get to the doctor. So then it's a matter of how do you get there without raising your heart rate as much as possible, you know, not racing and not running. They have a wonderful medical AeroVac system now in Washington, and you can utilize that if you're really out there someplace and that bite was in a severe area where your arm or leg was really starting to swell up. You could potentially get contact that way, but you got to get out. Yeah.
Any other questions for Keith?
I've got one for you. So if they show up at your residence and you don't want them to take up residence because of your kids and pets,
right?
What do you do?
So, you know, try to keep your bushes around your yard, your landscaping, trimmed up nice. Keep them up off the ground a little bit so they don't have cover to hide behind. Grass mowed down clean and fairly tight so there's not a place for them to lay around and feel that way. They're part of our nature here, and they will go into backyards, and I know many people have had them in their yard. I know some folks have had their dogs bit because dogs are curious about that. We'll get up onto them. The other really important thing, especially for kids, is baby rattlesnakes, for that first year of a rattlesnake, they don't have a rattle.
Yeah.
They don't have a button on them. So the rule is just don't mess with snakes, right? Don't try to pick them up because a small one this big is going to be poisonous. And if it doesn't have a rattle and you think it's a bull snake and you pick it up and it bites you, you're going to have a rattlesnake bite.
Wow. You know, also, I've always heard that bull snakes kill rattlesnakes, so keep the bull snakes around.
Yeah, bull snakes are good. I mean,
and they look similar.
Competition, they look similar.
They look similar.
All snakes are good in terms of being able to help take care of rodents, mice, you know, the other things that are not as healthy for you. So, yeah, live with them as opposed to being at odds. It's better. Yeah.
So, Keith, recognizing that the people that are listening to the recording don't know that you've got an audiovisual prop, you've got a nice skin tacked to a board, you know, how does it taste?
Like chicken. I'll tell you, it tastes like snake. Thank you very much.
Thanks Keith.
Commissioners, we have our agenda before us. Any changes that need to be made to the agenda? Hearing none, we'll move on to item 3, which is a substation siting community engagement.
Morning, commissioners. Andrew Wendell, Director of Customer Service, and with me is Teek Parks. She's our customer relations administrator. Maintain reliability in our electric system and maintain capacity for growth and expansion of our customer services. We need to build infrastructure. And sometimes we need to build power lines, water reservoirs, or substations to ensure we have that reliability and that capacity for our customers. And in doing so, strive to perform stakeholder engagement or customer outreach early in that process. This helps our customers understand our intent and what we strive to bring them for value and reliability and capacity. So two of the most current capacity needs, our planning standards have identified capacity needs in the Chelan area on the North Shore as well as in the Leavenworth area. So Tika Parks is here to update the board on our stakeholder engagement process for those two capacity improvement projects. So I'll pass it on to Tika.
Good morning, commissioners. So we just wanted to give you a quick overview today of what we've been doing since last summer and where we're at and where we're headed. So we said that we would check in with you in June when we started this process. So here we are. So we feel like we've really been collaborating in both these areas, both in Chelan and Leavenworth. So there's really been a lot of openness, a lot of transparency, and we feel like the community really does trust us at this point to bring them what they need to continue reliable service in their area. So we did use the outreach planning standard, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. We've done a lot. We've learned a lot. There definitely is a lot more to do. We know that the difficult conversations are still to come. So now that we are at the point where we have a top three area, our top three areas in both locations, We're starting to have those conversations with property owners and their neighbors. So definitely more to come, but we've gotten a lot done so far. One thing that we really appreciate is through this process, we've learned a lot. So for instance, in Chelan, we just assumed that if we put the substation behind all the houses, that no one would care because they all look at the lake, right? Well, that's not necessarily the case. They like to turn around and look at the hills. And so that was, you know, just a really good example of something that we learned when we started communicating with the customers in those areas. So on the flip side of that, they have learned a lot from us. In fact, I just had a conversation with a property owner who I'll talk a little bit more about this later, but who contacted us, and we had contacted his mother a couple of weeks ago and asked if she was interested in selling any property, and she said no. She didn't know anything about the process or how we'd gotten there at that point in time, and she just said, no, I'm not interested. Well, he called me today. He called me on Friday. I called him back today, and I was able to talk to him about how we got there and why we would want to put a substation in this area. So just the education piece of letting the community know why we need the substation and how we go about deciding where to put it and what all those PUD system requirements are has been huge. I think people in both the community meetings where we've had that larger community and then also in the focus group, just that education piece has been huge. So that's been really nice. So just a little bit about the outreach planning standard. We have been open and honest and talking with customers. I was talking to a gentleman a couple days ago last week, and I just said to him, I said, we're not hiding anything. I said, we're here to, you know, come up with a win-win. I said, I'll give you any information you need, and we had a great conversation. So it's nice to be able to say that, to be able to say that we've been open and honest and transparent, and we really are all trying to meet the same goal. I don't think at this point in time anyone is arguing with the fact that we need the substation. So we've moved far beyond that. So that's been really nice. Moving along with the outreach planning standard and the principles, we have provided a lot of opportunity for participation, both through the focus group and just taking input at the community meetings and taking phone calls. We've used a variety of engagement methods, and we're definitely collaborating. So there's a lot of two-way communication. And in the end, we want to choose a site that, like I said, is a win-win for everybody. In fact, Chad was in the hallway in Chelan a couple of weeks ago, and a guy came up to him, and I think you might have been standing with him, and he just said, why don't you guys just pick a site and condemn it? You know? And Chad said, that's not what we want to do. That is not what we are about, and we really want to find a win-win for both the PUD and the community. So I think that was kind of a nice, kind of poignant moment in this whole process. So like I said, there's been a lot of joint learning, a lot of education, and the focus group is, you know, a great alliance for us. So, like I said, we're utilizing the process to find a win-win and ultimately the best for the most for the longest period of time. So, I won't go through this entire slide in detail, but I just wanted to let you know that we do have the process documented and we are continuing to work toward memorializing that process. So we started by identifying the need for a substation. We did our engineering analysis. We started the community engagement process. We started the focus group. We defined what the focus group was going to do. We created site selection criteria, which was a huge milestone, and I'll actually show that to you on the next slide. We came up with a list of possible areas. We evaluated and narrowed using the site evaluation matrix there. I brought a small board to my left. We checked back in with the community. So that's what we're doing in Leavenworth here in a couple weeks and what we did in Chelan a few weeks ago. We're contacting property owners. And then we'll transition from areas, so bigger bubbles, to actual sites. And that's a huge piece of this whole process, is because up until this point, we've been able to say we have no site. We really are truly looking at an area. But through the next few weeks and the next couple months, we're going to be moving from an area to looking at actual sites, which is going to be a big transition. So we'll have the consultant perform some more detailed analysis. We'll check back in with the community. And then ultimately, by the end of the year, we will be checking back in with you with some proposals and some very more detailed information. So I just wanted to talk about the site selection criteria really quick. This was a huge piece that we put together. So PUD staff and the focus group together did this. And as you move down the document here, the statutory requirements are our non-negotiables. So those were things we came into the focus group and said, we absolutely have to follow these laws. This is what we're doing. There was no discussion there. So we move on down to PUD standards. Basically what we said are these are the things that the PUD does now to be able to use the mobile substation, all those sorts of things. We said if we want to do anything outside here, for example, build two smaller substations, changes the scope of what we're doing, and we need to have a discussion about our standards. So nobody really argued with that, and we moved on. So the site variables are what we used on the site evaluation matrix. This is where the community group had the most influence. So we talked about how far away we were from transmission lines to the service area to the view, all those sorts of things. So this is where the focus group had the most influence. And then once we actually do choose a site, these design variables will be things that we'll work with the neighborhood on to mitigate noise, lighting, fencing, landscaping, those sorts of things. So this was a really big document for us to finish. We used it in Leavenworth, and we hope to keep it around for a while. So we were really happy that we got there. Oops, sorry about that. Thank you. So the evaluation matrix was another deliverable. So you can see one completed one there for Leavenworth. We have some really great maps that we've been able to use. The lands fact sheet is actually something that we put together with a cover letter, and we sent out to all property owners in the top three areas in Chelan. And that's so it went out to people on Tuesday, and we've already gotten three or four calls from property owners saying I'm interested in having a conversation. So that's been really helpful. That was Steve's idea, and so that's a huge deliverable here. That detailed cost analysis and renderings that we'll bring to you by the end of the year, that'll be another big deliverable. And we're hoping that that is about three. That's what we're hoping for, is one actual site from each of the top three areas. So that's what we're working towards right now. So just to finish up with a status update, we had the community meeting in Chelan May 24th. We'll have the one in Leavenworth June 28th. We're currently contacting property owners in the top three areas for both of those locations. Once we get to the point where we've contacted all property owners and have a list of everyone who's interested, we'll look at their parcels and what pieces of property they're interested in selling, and we will do a preliminary cost analysis on each of those. And by reapplying that site criteria, and we'll try to come up with three sites. So that would be one site in each of the three areas. That's our goal. Then we would check back in with the community and then give those three sites to the consultant, and they would perform a detailed cost analysis, like I said, with renderings and things like that. And we would present that back to you as proposal by the end of the year. And then when we're all done with this, we will fully document the process and conduct a lessons learned review. Just a couple things we have learned up till this point is that this engagement probably adds about a year to the planning cycle, so we do want to think about that for the future. We may want to look into exploring land for future sites and purchasing that ahead of time, and then look at more opportunity to engage with city and county for their long-term planning. So I'll show you one more slide. This is the map in Leavenworth, so I don't think many of you have seen this. We'll present this on June 28th. I know Becky has been talking to some property owners, so this is not on our website right now, but it definitely is public. So this is where we got to in Leavenworth with our top three areas. So you've got, does the hot pink work, Eric? Okay, good deal. It was blue last week, so. So we've got one on the opposite end of town. You can see number three down there. That would provide some redundancy to where our current substations are. And then you've got our area kind of right there where our existing substations are. And then some more open land there behind where the high school is. So that's where we're at in Leavenworth. Any questions?
Yeah. Just on the Leavenworth map, sites 9 and 10,
uh-huh.
Do we already own that property?
Well, I might. We do own a parcel within there. Okay, yeah. Yeah, so you can see right there with the where that little yellow is, this is our where our existing substation is. So we do own some property in there. But there are some issues with siting an additional transformer where our existing two substations are. We already have stranded capacity in that area where you know, there's four circuits per transformer. So we would need eight out of there, and we're only currently getting seven circuits out of there. So there's some good things about it, but then also some things that would need to be worked on.
And the reason for the question was probably not more than an hour ago, I was asked by a Leavenworth resident who lives there, are you going to change that wooded area?
Oh, because he likes the wooded area?
Yeah, they
okay.
do. Yeah. They do. So, but it was just what else. I said, I don't know.
Yeah.
But let me ask.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I just want to add, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but in Leavenworth in particular, we had one community focus group member who said, well, why would we go back to the community without the detail of what it would look like to get transmission into that site and what it would look like to get distribution out? If I'm a property owner or I'm a neighbor, I want to know what that looks like. And then a guy on the other side of the table said, well, I live out on East Leavenworth Road, and the county came out and told us that they already had plans to straighten the road. And we were upset that they hadn't come to us earlier, so we kiboshed the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So you have to find this balance between taking too much detail to them so it looks like you've already made up your mind and going in with not as much detail as they want, but letting them know. So there's that balance. So that's a good question. We just don't know the answer yet.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and I didn't either, so yeah. This is helpful.
So, commissioners, thank you, Tika, for putting that information together. Just wanted to conclude by stating that, you know, we know that there are some tough decisions ahead of us, and even with an extensive outreach program, as Tika's demonstrated, we won't make everybody happy every time.
No.
Have we communicated openly and transparently, as Tika indicated? Yes. Have we listened and responded to the community concerns, the stakeholder concerns? Yes. Are we trying to mitigate those concerns as best as possible within the cost constraints and the policies that we adhere to? Yes, we are doing that. But at the end of the day, we will bring some recommendations forward for substation sites that best meet the criteria that the community and the PUD have collaborated on, and hopefully we will pursue those. It's likely that those site recommendations won't make everybody or all individuals completely happy, but we do believe that it is a focus on what is the best for the most for the longest. Hopefully we can mitigate everybody's concerns, and we'll commit to striving to do so through this process. But inevitably, in order to provide that capacity and reliability, we'll need to build these stations and select sites. I think, as Tika mentioned, we'll bring ideally a site of one site in each one of the three areas. And generally speaking, those should demonstrate, those cost analysis and design analysis should demonstrate the trade-offs for being close to our transmission lines or closer to the load centers, and help inform us what we're trading off to get the specific sites. So we look forward to that next step in the process.
Any other questions?
Additional questions? Just a comment. You must have coordinated this presentation with Keith Truscott, seeing that one of the prime sites is Rattlesnake Hill area.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like we're going to need to leave the rattlesnakes alone.
Thank you very much. Good presentation. Thank you.
Yeah.
Rock Island Powerhouse, B1 to B4 modernization.
Yeah, I want to invite Brett Bickford, and I think Kirk is going to join him to come up. So this is a really important presentation. We have some significant challenges. We've known about it, B1 through 4. We're not operating B1 through 4 right now because of the cracks that we have discovered in the turbines. And this sets up a workload for the next few years that is going to be an important part of implementing our strategic plan. And I want to also note that we've structured the order of the presentation today so that we're going to talk about the Powerhouse B1 through 4, give you a sense of what the implications are and some of the cost implications are, and then come back to the long-term debt philosophy and show you how the analysis on long-term debt philosophy becomes operational. And we're able to take an issue like this that has come up, didn't know it was going to come up when we were doing the analysis on long-term debt philosophy, and show you how that we're able to now respond and understand how an additional cost fits into our long-term financial picture. So I should have mentioned we're also going to invite Dan Garrison and Mark Mullins to the table as well. Kirk, up to you.
Morning. Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. With me we have Brett Bickford, Director of Engineering and Project Management. We have Dan Garrison, Director of the Hydros, and Mark Mullins, Director of Enterprise Risk Management. These three have led a tremendous effort to get to this point today. They've worked with a team of employees from across the district and multiple departments. They've been leading the effort, and we've had many people, some of which are here in the room today, involved in this analysis. You're going to see two parts to this. You're going to see the recommendation for B1 through 4, our oldest units in our fleet. And then you're going to see an element that we had to go through as part of the process. If you recall, we made decisions on C8 through 11 repairs. We made decisions on B5 through 8, Rock Island, Powerhouse 1. And then now we're faced with B1 through 4. Those other decisions we made were somewhat independent of each other. And now in light of B1 through 4, we had to do an analysis to look at, okay, now that we have everything stacked up in front of us, how would we go about and implement this? So the second part of this presentation you'll see is actually the schedule analysis that we went through, even looking at accelerating options for the repairs. So they're prepared to walk you through it. I think you'll find that there's not many, if any, stones that haven't been turned over in this analysis. So I'll let them take it away.
Good morning, Brett Bickford, Director of Engineering and Project Management. As Kirk mentioned, two parts of this presentation we're going to discuss the B1 to B4 evaluation. We'll be discussing the current state of the turbines and generators. We'll review the alternatives considered for their future use. We'll discuss the value of the units. And then we have a staff recommendation for rehabilitation. The second part is reviewing the extensive schedule analysis for B1 to B4 and how that would fit into all the hydro work that's going on for the next 5 years, and then to present a recommendation for the hydro work plan. At the end, then we can answer any questions and review a resolution that we've prepared for the B1 to B4 work. So the current state is back in 2010, we initiated a program to replace the stators on units B1 to B4, and we were able to complete that work on three of the units before we went into preservation mode. So units B3, B4, and B1 were done from 2010 to 2012. Unit B2 was operated until its air gap decreased below the point where we thought it was safe to operate. And so then that work was initiated in 2015. And then that work was recently completed on the B2 stator. The rotors on all the four units are original. They date back to 1931. So when we did the stator work, we did inspections, we did overhaul work, and it looked like the rotors still had some additional life, so they were put back into service. And those rotors, again, the original parts on them are the poles, which you can see in this photo around the perimeter, and then the rim, which is kind of hidden behind the poles, and then the spider, which is the steel structure that those things hang on, kind of nicknamed the spider because of the eight arms that are on that. And those, again, are all original components. The current state of the turbines, they are also all original equipment from 1931. In the 1980s, the blades were welded in a fixed state because it was no longer possible to manually operate those units, and they were set in various different blade positions to optimize their efficiency. In 2015, when the stator work was going on, a very detailed inspection was done of the turbine, as it was done on the other units. But what was surprising on B2 is it had a large number of blade cracks. The other units, out of all three of them, there were only two blade cracks found on all of the other units. But on B2, dozens and dozens. So engineering worked with consultants to come up with weld procedures. We used our district crews to perform weld repairs. We actually went through three rounds of weld repairs and finally concluded in February of this year that it wasn't, we weren't able to determine what way to have the blades, to get all the blade cracks repaired. What was very unusual as we would repair cracks is around the area that we were doing welding, more and more cracks would appear. And so in conclusion, then we also went back to B1, B3, and B4. Again, those units, when we inspected them between 2010 and 2012, didn't have cracks like this. We went back to those units, and surprisingly enough, they had many, many cracks as well. So we took, and here's kind of a table summarizing over hundreds of cracks on each unit. And again, on B2, after we fixed all the cracks that we knew of at the time, several weeks later, as we'd gone back, we would see 5 cracks, 10 cracks. And at the end of February, we had up to 26 cracks outside of the areas that we had even worked on. Here's a photo of some of the cracks that we see forming after the work's done. We took what we call boat samples, which is kind of taking about an 8-inch long by several inch deep, a sample out of the blades, sent them to 2 different metallurgy firms, had them do analysis of the metal. We had hoped when we'd seen cracks in B2 that maybe the B2 blade was just maybe not as high a quality of material, maybe cast at a different time at a different place. But we don't have records on that. But unfortunately, we found that the metallurgy on all the blades of all the units was the same. And the phenomena by the metallurgists of fatigue corrosion cracking was the same. So we made the conclusion that it was likely not feasible to go to the other units and try to do any work on those. So the current state on the B1 to B4 units is they're out of service due to the blade cracks until something can be done with them. We are continuing to look throughout the industry to see if there's folks that might have any recommendations on what we can do, but we think that would really only be kind of a short term in resolving any crack issues. And because of the uncertainty of cracks returning, that's why they are currently out of service. So alternatives were considered, such as retirement, which is defined by permanently removing those units from service, or in putting them in an inactive reserve state was option 2. And what that means is basically preparing them for kind of long-term storage until we could make a decision in the future whether they should be retired or if it would be economic to rehabilitate them. And then we also looked at rehabilitation and all the different options, which, again, were primarily turbine, but we also looked at the rotor as well. So some more in-depth about the different alternatives that we looked at. With retirement, some of the issues were the lost revenue from energy, capacity, encroachment, flexibility of operation, and also carbon-free. There'd be a FERC license amendment that would be required. With that amendment are some technical challenges in that we would have to determine how to replace the hydraulic capacity that those units now pass. There's about 26,000 cubic feet per second of water that those units can pass. And so we would have to determine whether we need to make modifications to the current water passages or whether we would have to do work at the spillway in order to increase the spillway's capability to pass that water. There'd be environmental studies for either of those alternatives to help identify any impacts on the environment, and particularly juvenile salmon and steelhead. Upcoming in 2020 is our habitat conservation check-in, where we confirm that we're meeting our obligations there. And so there's some risks in trying to make changes to the plant and get those changes in place prior to that check-in. And then we also identified that all this effort through the retirement, likely the cost to make those changes would approach what just a simple rehabilitation would cost. In our inactive reserve option, again, we'd have consultation with FERC and regulatory agencies to explain why we were putting them in an inactive reserve state and what the future might hold. We would still have to address the hydraulic capability issues on that interim basis. Again, that 26K would then need to be diverted over to the spillway. And we'd have to prepare new operating instructions and things like that for how to work with that. This increased spill could result in higher total dissolved gas issues. if we postponed under this inactive reserve issue, we would for sure then be into the HCP check-in period. And so that would have some effect long-term, and it might be subsequent additional studies we need to be done to confirm what the operation would be in the future. We have the cost and effort just to store these units in that inactive reserve situation. And then there'd be some uncertainty with power purchasers and size contracts on knowing what the district's future state was for those units. And then, of course, the lost revenue component. The alternatives considered in our rehabilitation option were the financial viability. Could we afford to do the work in relation to the revenue and benefits that were generated? We looked at the risk from a technical standpoint and what the solutions would be for the turbine. Construction issues and safety with trying to do that work in amongst the other work that's already planned, and the impacts on like the B5 to B8 contract.
So, Brett, if I may ask a question, and it may be covered later, but the issue of creating capacity for spill has a price tag with it. There's a price tag also associated with rehabbing. How far apart are those numbers?
We think those numbers are very close, okay. Just a couple million dollars difference.
Okay. So on the size of a project, you know, to the public hearing, a couple million dollars, and that's like real money. But the size of it, that's a fairly low percentage.
Yes, and as we present some of the results of the financial evaluation, that'll help become apparent that even though there's a couple million dollars, it's still significant that with that option of retirement, if it was a several million dollars less, that option has no future revenue value.
Correct. Right. Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions on the alternatives?
I have one quick question, just point of clarification. So that 26,000 cubic feet per second, is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
So moving on to the value of the B1 to B4 units, from a financial standpoint, looking at the different revenue streams of encroachment, capacity, energy, and carbon-free, we've identified over the next 50 years there's about $101 million present value. And again, comparing that to the other two alternatives, you would have no income, or none of this $101 million would be available if we retired the units. In addition to the monetary value of B1 to B4, there's a lot of value operationally. And again, this ability to hold maintain the headwater control. There's a maintenance flexibility when you want to work on other units, even though often because of the 18 units that are at Rock Island, some of them are not running. And so when they aren't, we can switch. We can do maintenance on short-term maintenance on a unit and then turn on 1 to 4 and run. Particularly in the future when we do rehabilitation work at Powerhouse 2, we will need, for every single unit that you have out at Powerhouse 2, you need 2.5 of the B1 to B4 units to make up that hydraulic capacity. So we see significant use on those units during that decade-long period of Powerhouse 2 rehab. From a natural resources standpoint, having these units available helps, again, mitigate the total dissolved gas. When you run it through the turbines, you don't create the gassing issue that you do when you send the water over the spillway. And then...
Again, if I may ask...
Uh-huh.
And get this, the question is more for public consumption, but if you move... if you eliminate the capacity of a 26,000 cubic feet per second and you move that to a spillway or do an alternate with that space, you know, where the turbine is now housed, to a certain extent, it negates almost all of the studies that we've done for the last 10 years and requires the reestablishment of HCP and data collection, et cetera, to validate our fish passage. Is that accurate?
That's correct, yep.
Yeah. It's just not a simple movement of where water is going to go. It has all kinds of connections.
Correct.
Yeah.
And along those same lines, in your evaluations up to this point,
you really haven't been able to put what a potential cost figure might be on those last two natural resources numbers, I'm imagining.
No, we haven't.
I mean, that's an unknown.
Correct. Yep. All we've been able to do is pretty much kind of the physical structures and not those two items, right?
Of course, if we were looking for it, it could force an early retirement of Keith Truscott.
No comment necessary.
It doesn't deserve one.
So after considering the three different use options, the recommendation of the staff is to go forward with a rehabilitation of units B1 to B4. So then looking at rehabilitation options, there's the replace the turbine in kind with kind of the old design. The reason for that would be, from a simplistic standpoint, is less time and effort spent on trying to do design work to come up with a new option. The second alternative, though, is to replace with a more modern design that has advantages. Then we can maybe take advantage of the new technology that we have with fish-friendly turbines as well as efficiency gains. But with the modern design, more cost can come with that as well, as you're trying to craft a more modern unit. What comes with that is some changes to the draft tube, the runner and the hub, the discharge liner, the bottom ring and the wicket gates, the head cover and the turbine shaft. So it's a lot more extensive of effort to look at new technology. There's quite a few benefits that we learned on units 9 through 10 by looking at that technology. We would use a lot of that effort and time spent from 9 and 10, and we think we could advance and use those things on 1 through 4. Because of those costs and effort spent, we think we could go forward with 1 through 4 much faster. From what we've done on 9 and 10, we know that we can get higher efficiency on these units. With that would come a little bit of an increase in hydraulic capacity, which would be beneficial, again, from being able to handle water that could go over the spillway. We could make these units much more fish-friendly. If we go with a fixed blade design, we can have the complete runner welded to the hub, and then we eliminate all the gaps that exist between the hub and the runner that fish can get pinched in. We could reduce the number of blades from 6, which is currently what they have, to 4. We could also, with a fixed blade design, we could get rid of any oil in the hub because we wouldn't have to adjust the blades. We've talked with some of the big suppliers. They've looked at our design, and the manufacturing details are quite simple, so we don't have as many concerns with manufacturing and technical issues. We think there's cost savings, again, in that if these units are running pretty much at the outer end of the hydraulic capacity of the plant, we kind of know there's a more limited head range as opposed to the full head range, and then we can have those blades fixed at that angle that they're most frequently going to run at. And getting rid of the adjustable blade capability can save $3 or $4 million per unit on the turbine side.
So I just need a little more explanation there.
Sure. But,
will you say that again? So these are running at full capacity, or you said on the spectrum they're running on the outer edge of what? How'd you explain that again?
Sure. So at Rock Island, as the river flows go from zero, basically, to what I call the hydraulic capacity of the plant, which is about 220 cubic feet per second, the head changes. And so the head decreases as the river flow increases. How these units would be planned to be operated is that when flows would be about 160 and greater, then these units would typically is when they would come online. So when we have flows of that high, we know what the head of the plant is, which is typically kind of 38 feet or less. And so we could design these units with a blade angle such that they're optimum and have very high efficiency at that 38 foot and less head, as opposed to trying to design them to run all the way to 50 feet.
Yeah.
Then that's where the advantage of adjustable blades come in. So the other units could run at a 50 foot or a 45 or a 40 or a 35. So then those blades can adjust for that full range to optimize efficiency.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Uh-huh. So along with that recommendation to go forward with a rehabilitation of the units with using a modern design runner, we've looked at the labor resource to do the work. We believe what the best option would be for the district would be to contract for all the new component manufacturing as well as unit disassembly and reassembly. We would use our district wiremen, however, to do the electrical work. The turbine would be all new, again, fixed blade. Most all of the components would be new since they're already 85 years old, and learning from work on 9 and 10 as well as C8 to C11 and trying to reuse components and then having to come back in the middle of the program and have to buy new ones, we recommend going forward with purchasing mostly all new except for assessing the wicket gates because those were recently refurbished when we were doing the stator work, and as well as the guide bearing and the gate operating ring. But we would look at those, try to get an additional 50 years of life out of them, and if it didn't seem that we could through finite element analysis and other engineering evaluation, then those would be replaced as well. On the generator, since the stators are new, we would reuse those as is. And then on the rotor, we would replace the poles and rim and spider. There's actually some other projects already budgeted for units 1 through 4. They were budgeted several years ago, and that was for governor controls and excitation and fire protection. And so those previously budgeted projects would be performed at the same time as these outages occur to combine all that work at one time.
Looking back a few years at this maybe a purely nostalgic question to the ironwood bearings.
Yes.
These are the generators, right?
Yes. These turbines have the ironwood bearings, yes.
And those would be gone?
We're evaluating those. I would propose that it's 50-50 on whether they might be used again.
That's simply amazing.
Yeah. Throughout the industry, they're finding that, so they've been trying to use composite manufactured simulated bearings. And they're finding that they don't last as long as the original wood, ironwood, or lignovita bearings. Yeah,
it's still amazing every time we talk about it.
Nature does it best.
Yep. And in part of this evaluation, too, we also evaluated about whether or not to defer some of the work on components we think might have maybe 10 years or 15 years out of this 50-year life. And through that evaluation, it was determined that it makes more sense to do the work now, as opposed to having outages 5, 10, 20 years into the future. So, putting it together, summing our recommendation on what the work scope is, on who should do the work, the schedule of the work, we've come up with an estimated budget of about $15 million per unit. And then using that monetary value that we identified before of about $101 million in net present value, a net present value of the project then works out to be about $46 million. So total revenue benefits, total costs over the duration of time to do the work, and then the life of 50 years results in that $46 million NPV. That works out for the district to be a 12.2% internal rate of return. We did some sensitivity analysis to that as well and said, well, what if in the future the Wanapum encroachment were to be changed and it's not tied to the unit, it's not tied as a direct revenue source? That reduced the internal rate of return to 9%. And then we continued with some sensitivities to look at what would it take to get down to a 7%, which is the kind of the internal minimum for the district on a return on a project like this. And so to do that, it was a combination of going to a 15% cost increase, so that's above the $15 million. We removed encroachment, and then some of the carbon-free values that have been estimated for the future came down to current rates. And then also capacity and energy markets were reduced by 6%. So that combination of all those things gets us down to the minimum threshold of 7%.
Thanks, Brett.
Yeah.
Dan Garrison, Director of Hydro Operations. As this board well knows,
We've been in some extraordinary activity for the last several years. And I was in this room several months ago, meeting with Steve Wright and Kirk Hudson when we were finally coming to the resolution for ourselves that the B1 through 4 units were at the end of their life. And Steve had asked the question, given this recent event, reaching the end of his life, do we need to reconsider the schedule of all of our projects? And so that we've also been embarking on, and that's what I want to review here today, is and what we'll recommend is that, no, we do want to change things up. We want to revise things based on what we know now. So we're doing a lot of work. Obviously, 1 through 4, Brett just went through that, but you also know that we have a lot of work going on at Rocky Reach. The large turbine repairs, windings on the large units are now an issue. We need to get some major bridge crane project work done up there, as well as head covers and also 1 through 7 overhauls. We're already engaged in the rehab of units 5 through 8, B5 through 8 at Powerhouse 1. Governor controls a Powerhouse 2. And then down the road, 2021-ish, you know, we know that we want to start engaging in the Powerhouse 2 modernization. And then our friend, Mr. Truscott, keeps reminding us that there is an HCP check-in out there in 2020 at Rock Island, and we want to have normal operations, if that's possible, when we get into that time frame. So having said all of that, we reviewed all of this work and came up with no less than 16 various schedule options to review and analyze. And through the last several months, we've narrowed those down to status quo. Option 7, which I will get into a little bit more detail later, and then our recommended option number 11. So this review was pretty extensive. I had asked for a special team to start collecting data for me and others. We got the benefit of Janelle Ulrich, volunteered to lead a Cracker Jack team and work with all of our planners and engineers, project managers to collect all this data for the next decade or so, so we can review all these alternatives. And of the things that we needed to analyze were the impacts on internal and external resources. What is the impact to projects and their schedules and their priorities? We needed to compare revenue benefits with respect to the impacts of labor and other contracts. We also needed to engage all of our internal stakeholders and draw on their expertise as to recognize what's important to them as we proceed through all these schedule evaluations. And then lastly, we need to mitigate the risk so that we protect the value for our external stakeholders. And then so the fun begins. There's three next slides, and I'm going to not get into the detail because there's a lot of information out there. We have one of the options, the recommended option on the poster board as well to refer to. But this is the status quo, and in general, I'd just like to introduce to you that the left-hand side of this chart represents all 31 of our generating units, everywhere from Chelan up at the top, through Powerhouse 1, Powerhouse 2, and then Rocky Reach on the bottom. Along the top, you see the next several years through 2022. So what's important on this particular slide is you see a lot of red. And in general, what the red is representing is a unit is out of service, but there's no work going on. It's waiting. And then at the end of most of those red rows, you'll see some green sections. Okay. Let's go to the next slide. Schedule 7 is our most aggressive alternative we considered. And what the new color you see up here is a lot of blue. And that blue represents unit availability that we were able to recover as compared to the status quo option. And we achieved that mostly by overlapping outages. And you can see that at Rock Island, all of the B5 through 8 outages are now overlapped by roughly 6 months, as well as we are overlapping the B1 through 4 outages. Very aggressive. That particular schedule at Rock Island also means that we have to buy additional equipment. We don't have enough head gates to do all of that dewatering work and support those projects. It's also a huge demand on people. And then on the bottom end of that Rocky Reach, we also looked at those projects. Similarly, overlapped outages. That became more of a decision not to go that way because the revenue gained at the end, the blue that you see out there, is offset plus some more by doubling up outages now. It's more expensive to have multiple outages in the near term and rather than saving it in the long term. So that became financially less attractive.
So, Dan, sorry, I have to catch up here. So the green, I know what the red is, the blue, what the green represents overlap?
What's the green? The green is trying to represent that there's actually work going on in the site, in the field.
Did I miss no.
There's no legend.
No legend there, yeah. For.
Yeah, it's a verbal legend. Sorry. Did that answer your question?
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Okay. Next slide, please. So here's our recommended option. Rocky Reach, we're proposing to leave pretty much alone. The advantages of accelerating that schedule aren't there financially. It certainly complicates a lot of resource needs, so we just want to leave that alone as it is now. At Rock Island, though, what we propose is to continue with the rehab of units B6 and B7. They're already in progress. They're already out of service. And in that period of time, Brett and his group, engineering, will be putting together bid specifications, all that sort of work. And they believe that we could have this new equipment arrive in about October of 2018. So we propose to interrupt the projects for B5 and 8, push them out in the future, and then insert units B1 through 4. And what you can see, if we do that, we recover nearly as much of all the forced outage as we did in the super aggressive schedule. It's not quite as beneficial, but the costs are far less to get this. It's far less complicated, and it's much more feasible just to complete it this way. So, and then after B1 through 4 is complete, you can see right out here in 2020, this purple line and that red line and the cloud of information, that is when the HCP check-in is for Rock Island. So we would have 1 through 4 complete before then. And then as soon as the HCP check-in is finished, we would resume the projects on B5 and 8.
Quick question on Schedule 11. Right in the middle, there's a potential Rocky Reach JFB projects.
Yes, that's a note that to ourselves that it's been many years since we built the initial juvenile fish bypass system. And so we are projecting that in about that time frame, we may have some significant work to complete there. Okay.
So looking at all the hydro work going on, we've found an opportunity to squeeze the B1 to B4 work within that 5 to 8 program. So what that means for us to also be able to try to heat, to achieve one of the objectives is to try to get done before the HCP check-in. And so we need to start work immediately. My team would start working on bid specifications and contract documents with PCS with the goal of trying to get out to bid by September of this year, with the second goal of trying to be able to award a contract by January 2017. If we can hit those two milestones, then we should be able to do the design for 1 through 4 and do manufacturing such that we can get parts available by that fall of 2018. After we know for sure, by awarding the B1 to B4 contract, then we could revise the B5 to B8 contract that we currently have. With equipment on site in by October 2018 and with our current assumption of 6-month outages, then if we have a little bit of overlap, we can achieve all 4 units being complete by March 2020. So then Dan led the effort to look at the resources to execute this recommendation. And so these resources were identified not just because of 1 through 4, but looking at the complete scope of all the work. So adding in Rocky Reach work, the current B5 to B8 work, the work at Powerhouse 2 with Governor Controls, and then the result of that was this recommendation.
So to complete the recommendations, we believe we need an additional 4 wiremen and 2 technicians, 2 additional control systems engineers, an additional project manager, and an additional construction manager for Brett's group. We believe that HR has additional hiring and payroll and benefits workload issues taken care of. PCS and legal, these will put more strain on those departments, but the recommended option is minimizes those. And then the added craft people in the short term will address succession planning, but in future years we expect future retirements to come up and provide those opportunities to attrition down to normal levels.
So, Dan, when you talk about added craft resources, that's in reference to what you mentioned up above, the 4 additional wiremen, technicians, control systems engineers?
Mostly wiremen and technicians.
Yeah, not additional beyond what you itemized out up above.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
So some of the assumptions that we made in coming up with this recommendation include that the blade cracks are not repairable for long-term operation, that the B5 to B8 units continue to operate through 2021. So in those 3 schedules, there weren't any red for those. If those were to either have air gap or other issues that we would take them out of service, we would need to reevaluate when to do those units. We're also making the assumption that Powerhouse 2 units continue to operate through 2021. Again, if we had issues with those units, then we would need to reevaluate the priority of the work. We're also making some assumptions, but we have been talking with equipment providers. We do believe we can get things by fall 2018, but we don't have a contract in place, so there's some risk in that. Also, there's some assumptions in that, so the HCP check-in has environmental conditions to deal with as well. It's planned to be done in 1 year now, but if it's an extremely abnormal water year, then it might, our internal resources have identified that we might have to do an additional check-in, and then that would postpone proceeding with the B5 to B8 work. Again, additional unit outages at any of the hydros might affect the current plan that we're recommending today. In our decision evaluation criteria, we've identified through our five different criteria, what are the first starting with what are impact on our customer owners. Significant economic value can be derived if we go ahead and proceed with modernization of these units. Again, we can expect to get about a 12.2% return from our energy encroachment capacity and flexibility. Inserting B1 to B4 prior to 5 through 8 optimizes the unit availability, and with our labor and contracted resources, it levelizes that so we don't have a huge spike like we did in that alternative 7. It also mitigates our risk in that if we have issues with equipment in the plant, such as cranes, if we had multiple units out at a time, then that just doubles our risk and impact. So again, our alternative is not having multiple units stacked on top of each other, which then if you have a problem with any of the equipment, you have twice as much cost and impact to contracts. The incremental capital is about $15 million per unit. It's not in the current forecast, again, because this is a new project. We believe that doing and providing a design of for 50 years makes the most economic sense, and it minimizes our outage time over that duration. This also supports the strategic objectives to invest in our long-term assets to provide maximum value.
Let me ask a question.
Yeah.
Just so that I can get my mind around it a little bit, not that long ago, we rebuilt the two units at Lake Chelan, somewhere between $50 and $60 million, so approximately $25 to $30 million each. These are coming in at approximately $15 million. What's the differential? Is it the size of the turbine? Is it the scope of the work? Is it...
Yeah, two primary factors. One, again, is that we're going with fixed blade.
Okay.
So that can save $3 to $5 million per unit. Wow. And then we've also already replaced the stators. And so that was another $5 million that we already spent.
Yeah.
We get some economy of scale when we're doing four units. So the initial design effort can be recouped over four as opposed to two, as well as the whole manufacturing process. In this contract, it'll be the first one that we've done in several years that we're contemplating going ahead and releasing all four units. The other contracts we've been kind of doing one at a time. Let's design it. Let's install it. Let's confirm that it works. So then all that has additional cost. And so this is the most economic way to do it. But then there are some risks in those things.
Yeah. Okay. And that's really helpful because that's a question I assume that will be asked.
Gary?
Question. I like the fact that we're pegging this over 50 years. Obviously, amortizing that cost over a longer period of time brings the profitability higher. What's the comfort of a 50-year period? I mean, are you comfortable that these parts can be designed and actually fulfill that 50-year time span?
Yes, we believe so. And there are two reasons for that. One is that what we've learned over the last decade on buying components, we believe we can put together contract specifications and requirements that will get us that 50 years. These units lasted about 85, so we know it can be done as long as you have the right design criteria. So we think it can. The other thing is that their utilization isn't as high as the other units, so we think we can get that additional. Often you might hear 40 years. We think we can get additional 10 because they're not operated as much.
Thank you.
Yeah. And the bottom line is there's probably no one in this room that's going to see whether that happens or not.
But we're still going to try.
What? Oh, 50 years? I can do the math.
That's sobering, yes.
And with that happy note.
All right, our decision evaluation criteria number two, what are stewardship implications and impacts to the environment? So by returning these back to service, we have reduced spill volumes as compared to the other alternatives. Again, less reliance on the spillway, risk of flooding. So where that comes into normal operation is if you were to have a load rejection at one of the powerhouses, let's say Powerhouse 2, and that complete plant shuts offline, what you have to deal with is all that river momentum, all that water coming down the river that can't just stop. And so then what has to happen at Powerhouse 1, all those units have to fire on. Or if they're not available, then all the spill gates have to start opening. So there's reaction time to that. So there's the large flood event of an upstream, you know, either climatic event or an upstream breach of a dam. But we have the real short-term event is right at the powerhouse if something trips offline from a lightning storm or something like that, that we still have to be able to react to flooding. It's real short-term. Again, no risk of oil if we go with a fixed blade design. We think through a smaller hub design, if we get rid of the internal components required to adjust the blades, hubs can be smaller, we can actually pass more water and get a little more increase in hydraulic capability. We can use what we know about fish-friendly features of turbines. We can incorporate those and get, hopefully, improved fish passage survival. And if we can have this all done by 2020, we can even test that and confirm, and maybe even we can tune down a little bit of our spill if we get really good results.
Quick question.
Is that the bulb design, the fish-friendly design? Is that the bulb?
The bulb units are very fish-friendly, but what I'm referring to is what we've learned about and minimizing blade strikes, so that's reducing your number of blades. That's making a partially spherical discharge liner so that you minimize gaps as the blades rotate. If you have cylindrical walls, then as the blades rotate, you increase the gap between the blade and the wall or the discharge liner. And so as the gap increases, more water flows through there and more fish can go through there. And if you're at a gap that's kind of the size of a fish body, then you can get impingement.
Hmm.
And so we can design those features into it now, which aren't incorporated. So it's cylindrical, six-bladed runner. We can change those things and hopefully improve survival.
Hmm. Thank you.
So thinking about efficiency, do you anticipate generating some incremental increases out of current capacity versus future capacity with this?
Yes, we do. Yep.
Significant?
Yeah, I think it's significant, and currently they operate around the 80 to 82% efficiency. Mm-hmm. And so in the contract, we're going to ask for a minimum of 88%. It's likely they can get 90. So hoping to get 6 to 8, maybe even 10% efficiency gain.
And that will be electricity that we can sell as that incremental.
That's additional power generated from the same volume of water as today. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
So legal implications, if we continue with operating those units and go down the rehabilitation route, we don't have the impacts that we would see to the current license. And so as we've seen on other unit rehabs, it's notifying FERC that what we're doing, supply with them our plans and specs, and we pretty much get approval to go forward with that without any studies that need to be done and additional costs associated with that. So the other alternatives that we evaluate have much higher level of FERC involvement and risk on what FERC might require us to do. You know, whether it opens up other obligations to do other studies and things like that. But because we're proposing to replace pretty much in kind, similar hydraulic capability and production, we stay within the bounds of our current license. We will put together contract documents that give us some flexibility and scope again so that we can maybe reuse a few components that we've already refurbished again for the long term. And our scheduled timing, however, will impact the 5-8 rehab project. We do have contract terms already that define schedule changes. And so those schedule changes, we know what they are, so they can be quantified. And right now they include there's a labor escalation based on whatever the millwright labor rate change is. And so typically that's 2 to 3% a year. And then we also have in the contract, if there's commodity price changes, currency changes, those things can all be handled. So it's fair, it's known what they are, and so we can quantify those as we go forward. So our workforce and operations implications, again, very detailed study, comprehensive study of all the work going forward, what that effect would be. And so we've come up with a recommended work plan and the number of FTEs, and so that included those additional wiremen and technicians and engineers, project managers, et cetera. We know there's a significant impact on existing projects, so lots of coordination needs to happen, particularly at Powerhouse 1, as we change from one contract on and doing work on 5 through 8 to the B1 to B4. So other stakeholder implications. By the district not doing a deferred option, whereas we're not sure what we're going to do in the future, we know what our solution is. We can predict what our capability and energy will be. We can maintain the flexibility we have now in operations. And so those things help us with our power purchasers and with slice contract sales going forward. The cost of this project, because it'll be new equipment, will be capitalized. So there's not the immediate hit that our power purchasers get from expensed items. Fish agencies will know what we're doing going forward, so there won't be uncertainty on is the plant going to be in a significantly different operation when we go into HCP check-in. We'll work with them to show the different fish-friendly features that we're proposing to incorporate, so we believe they'll be happy with those units changing to the modern designs. And we believe with FERC, they'll also be supportive of what we're doing with maintaining our hydraulic capacity through generating units as opposed to trying to come up with a new solution to dispatch it another way through some other device that's installed in those water passages or through modifying the spillway. So impact on our values, safety-wise, we have some increased short-term risk that's always associated with construction work, but we think through the plan, as opposed to trying to stack multiple unit outages on top of each other, that this levelizing the workload has the least risk with reduced to safety and the complexity of getting the work performed in the plants. With regard to stewardship, we maintain our hydraulic capacity. We support our fish passage initiatives to do the best we can, and all these things help provide that additional value to our customer owners. Through trustworthiness, supports our long-term relationships with our current purchasers. They're not getting a surprise in what they expected that they would see over the course of their current contract terms. As well, it provides stability and some assurance with our slice contracts that are coming up. It's also consistent with our strategic plan to maintain our assets and to keep those in good working order. Through operational excellence, again, providing operational flexibility at the plants, we are going to go forward with the modern design so we can realize those efficiency improvements. By having our crews get to do some of the work, particularly the wiremen and technicians, they can learn and then better maintain those assets over the course of their operation because they installed them. They'll be familiar with how they can do maintenance on them.
That's a big plus. Yep. I like that.
So our proposed next steps, we did prepare a resolution today or for the future that would authorize the funds that we need to get district staff and some consultants to be able to complete the bid documents and get through the bid solicitation phase by the end of this year. That resolution also includes our staff hiring recommendations, and that's needed so because it's mid-year, our human resources department can be confirmed in what work that they need to do to support us. This project has additional requirements through our procedures to come back to the board. So not only is there the resolution to approve the work and the hiring, but per our policies, we would come back in about September to do the actual resolution to advertise. And that's where we would provide more details on what the contract scope is and duration and some of the different risks in contracting the various different ways. Again, then if we can meet our target of getting bids in by the end of the year, then in January we would come with another contract that would make an award to the contractor who would be doing, again, the design manufacturing and would do the disassembly and reassembly. So approving the project means a $60 million capital budget change to our forecast. Again, we're estimating $15 million per unit times four units is $60 million. We're proposing that be put into the forecast now so our financial team can evaluate what that means over the long term. It would set up a capital project again. We would set it up for the first unit B4 for $350,000. Summarizing again the FTEs, it's four wiremen, two technicians, two control system engineers, a project manager, and a construction manager, and then changes to the B5 to B8 contract. Any final questions we can answer?
Additional questions?
Great analysis, because you've done a lot of work. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. I'm just going to make one comment, I think. I really like it. I think it's a great move forward. I particularly like the flexibility of going one through four and then having those options available when we go into Powerhouse 2. You're going to be able to switch over, and it gives us a lot more flexibility, and I think it positions us really well into the future. So I think that's the key. So, yeah, it's a good presentation. I like it.
Thank you.
Other comments? Brett, this is a big event.
Yes, it is.
It's a big deal.
Yes, it is.
And I know you're aware, we've established a process here at the commission level over a period of years of really attempting to, with any project or any resolution, attempting to provide a maximum amount of time for the public to provide input into that. And generally speaking, presentation in the morning, we've been talking about it. We've all been aware that we were going to be having to do some things. But a resolution in the afternoon right after that is generally not the practice that we have adopted. Now, well, it'll be up to my fellow commissioners, and maybe we should, talk about it a little bit right now, whether or not we really want to act on the resolution that you've got presented to us right now or put it on the calendar for 2 weeks from now. I look to my fellow commissioners because that it is entirely up to us.
Well, I guess again, what is the real impact to you and the project if we wait for 2 weeks?
So, from the project manager's perspective, time is money. The value with these is that they're down now, and so it's the cost of the units being down. But we do agree. We totally understand the prudent need to review and look at the documents. And so we prepared the resolution in case you wanted to act, but we understand, which is normal to wait 2 weeks.
And it gives the public the opportunity to provide additional thoughts.
Absolutely.
To the commission and to the utility. So. Thoughts, commissioners?
Well, I'm okay with voting this afternoon on the resolution. As one commissioner.
Yeah, my thoughts are this is nothing that snuck up on us.
Right.
This has been an ongoing process. So, I do have a little bit of discomfort in stepping away from our normal procedures. But it's not this isn't an unknown.
I'll just step in. I'm comfortable with you bringing the resolution forward and moving forward with it.
All right.
There's three.
Yep, you bet. Okay.
All right, thank you.
Public input on presentation.
Darren Klingensmith, I just have a quick question for you guys. Is there any possibility that one or more of the units can be torn down and prepared for the arrival of the equipment before it gets here? Like right now, some stuff can be starting to be torn apart, or is that completely unreasonable?
No, that is definitely possible. We actually, it's subtle, but in Dan's schedule, it actually shows that we would start the disassembly of the first unit prior to all the equipment showing up. Typically, we don't do that because we don't want to tear down something prior to, in case there's an issue with getting lots of parts from overseas and having transportation issues. But because they're already down, that's what we show on our schedule, is actually about 2 months before. Go ahead and having the disassembly completely done before parts arrive. And we would wait until then just because current crews are already scheduled to do work. They're fully allocated right now, so we would wait until that started in that year.
Thank you. Additional questions or comments from any member of the public? Super. Steve?
Could I just say one thing? I Mark's been really quiet here today, and I just want to note that I really think that this is important, the way the analysis has been done, the quality of the analysis, the comprehensiveness to look across all of the district silos and think about the different elements, and the quantitative nature of it, too, to make sure that with the different factors that are taken into account, we actually drive them down to a conclusion about, so quantitatively, how does that fit into the analysis? And Mark's a really critical component of pulling that together, and it's just done a fantastic job so that we're not basing our decisions on gut instincts, but on a really thorough analysis. This is a robust conclusion, as you saw. I want to underscore a point that Brett made, that $46 million net present value compared against a no-action alternative. And the no-action alternative is not viable. It is not possible to have these units either be retired or go into an inactive status without some substantial cost. We didn't drive that all the way to specifics because it became clear that the analysis didn't need it to get to a conclusion, but there would be substantial costs associated with either of those two alternatives. So this is analysis that works under a variety of different future scenarios that would come forward. So I wanted to say a particular thanks to the whole team, but just because Mark didn't step up to the plate today, I want to make sure it's known that he was a big contributor to this effort.
I just have one comment. So that helps explains to me why you brought forward three different options, and status quo, was one of them. And I thought, why is that one that you're bringing that you seriously think we should consider? But you're bringing more as a kind of a baseline to then look at the other two.
Correct.
From.
Yep. Status quo again is, let's do what we've already got on the books. It's already committed contractually, which particularly is 5 through 8. We have a contract and a schedule, and then these would follow that. And then, as Steve asked us to look at, well, if we just did that, what does that mean? And so then what came to light is a number of things. Yeah, the revenue, the HCP impacts, yeah. Right.
Okay, that's helpful.
Thank you. We'll see you this afternoon then.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, next up, and very fitting, given the presentation that you just heard, we want to talk about, for the third time, the long-term debt philosophy, and get back to you on some questions that you asked, and also think a little bit about the implications of a Rock Island investment relative to the information you've been seeing previously about what the potential impacts would be on our long-term borrowing rates, and other considerations.
Thank you, Steve. I'm Debbie Litchfield. I'm treasurer for the district, and with me is Heather Ireland, who's our lead treasury analyst. As Steve mentioned, this is the third in the series of conversations that we've been having with you with respect to our long-term debt philosophy. And at this point, I'm just going to go ahead and turn it over to Heather to provide kind of an overview of where we've been and some additional analysis, and then also look for some affirmation from you as well. So, Heather?
Good morning. Again, Heather Ireland, Lead Treasury Analyst for the District. Presentation purpose for today, I've been here the last two board meetings and helped provide some information about some key considerations related to our long-term debt structure and also some scenario analysis that have helped us to shape and refine an extension of our long-term debt philosophy and planning strategies post-2019. I've talked a little bit about how building plans that are flexible and realigned periodically through time as we approach decision points supports the district's financial health and keeps our electric rates low and stable. We've also discussed what tools are available for the commission in their toolbox should we experience low probability challenging events so that we can best position ourselves well in advance and are able to respond with reasonable, acceptable choices in the future. Again, today, no formal action is being requested. We did want to pause and confirm, though, that we've been able to incorporate your vision into the long-term debt philosophy and planning scenarios. So to start with, I just wanted to do a quick recap about where we've come And really our most recent session 2 weeks ago with the scenario analysis, I hope helped demonstrate that ultimately our debt philosophy should support doing the best for the most for the longest, which we are most able to accomplish when liquidity and leverage are balanced, which provides us ample time and tools to respond should challenges arise. Planning time and options in the future are the benefits of continuing to work towards a low leverage number now as financial results allow. The balanced approach really translates into what our long-term debt philosophy and planning strategies are. And before we move on to specifically going over those statements, I do want to provide a little bit of additional information from a couple of scenarios, both in response to some questions in the last session and also providing a little bit of a look into as you consider the recommendation for the B1 through B4 repairs at Rock Island. One question that was asked last time was, in an alternative look, in a stressed case, what if we cut our capital? Would we be able to cut capital enough to avoid potential rate increases over time? So I wanted to provide a scenario look at that. This scenario, again, is the ongoing severely stressed wholesale sales, assuming low water and low price year over year. It still includes the base cost growth of approximately 3% per year. But instead of assuming that capital is at the current forecast or increased, it assumes that we cut capital by approximately 35%, or about $30 million each year. Reducing costs, including capital expense, is a valuable tool to consider in the toolbox. It would be available to mitigate challenging financial conditions. However, as you can see under these assumptions, while we would be able to meet our financial metrics, that is a fairly significant reduction to capital. It would allow us to avoid rate increases, but it may not be something that's plausible entirely. Also, this ties in nicely to how we've talked about this morning about the potential recommendation for the B1 through B4 upgrades. What about on the other side if we had increases to capital? In the stress scenario, if we did have increases to capital in the approximate amount of $60 million in the near term, we would still be able to maintain our financial metrics even under the stress scenario using those same tools that we discussed previously in the analysis, holding growth down, utilizing rate increases in the range of 3-5% per year beginning in 2020. So it wouldn't be substantially different than the case we had looked at previously. Again, this highlights why our long-term debt philosophy and planning strategies help provide stability and options and plenty of planning time. Additionally, I wanted to give you a look at, in the expected case, if the board does decide to pursue the recommended B1 through B4 upgrades, what would it look like in our base scenarios? This base scenario, again, includes approximately 3% of O&M growth year over year. It includes our current capital forecast plus the Rock Island work and highlights our flexibility and our ability to choose from different options. The first thing that we would recommend looking at would be curtailing part of our early debt reduction strategy. So right now, this scenario would show that in 2019, rather than doing additional early debt retirement, we would revert and just do our scheduled debt retirement. This would allow us to continue to meet all of our financial metrics, both within the five-year forecast and post-2020. It would also continue to have a declining leverage number. We would still be below 35% in 2018, and we would just continue to gradually decline that number. In 2027, that number would be approximately under 20%, or about $250 million. We'd still be able to maintain our liquidity with a mix of pay-as-you-go and financed capital projects, and we would also be able to maintain our debt coverage above 2 times.
Excuse me.
Sure.
What would the debt be in 2020?
This number would be representative of the debt in 2027. In 2020, our debt outstanding would be it'd probably be around $375 million, somewhere in that range.
Thank you.
A side question, if you forego the opportunity in 2019 for accelerated debt reduction, is that an opportunity that's once only and it's therefore lost after that? You could do it at some point in the future?
Yes, we would still maintain the flexibility to do that at any point okay. in the future.
Okay.
In 2019, we have certain series of bonds that become callable. We issued them in 2009 with a 10-year call protection. So they become currently callable in 2019, where we could take them out, but we could certainly choose to do so at any point before their final maturities okay. into the future.
I have a question.
Yes.
On the 2019, what is the average interest on those bonds that are callable?
On those bonds that are callable, I don't have the exact numbers, but the majority of our portfolio right now is in the 4 to 5% range. Is that seem consistent?
That's correct.
Thank you.
What would likely happen is once the board has made a decision on the B1 through B4 upgrades, that information would be incorporated into our financial forecast. We would reevaluate as we frequently do to see if our operational plan of finance needs to be updated to take those bonds out of our base assumption. And then we would, of course, continue to monitor that as we go forward to future decision points. If our financial results improve and we continue to have good outcomes year over year, we still may have the opportunity to do that retirement in 2019. Or if we have challenges and we are in difficult circumstances, we could certainly defer future debt reductions as well.
Yeah. Unless you need it. I want to go back to the rate design. You know, we talk about these different scenarios where we don't have any rate increase. We have small rate increases over time, but it's usually reflective of a situation that we have to react to. As we go through and we have budgets every year, our budgets increase. And so have we looked at a way of looking at a rate design that actually maintains what we actually charge our customers and what it actually costs to produce this? And then maybe look at a scenario where it maintains that level. I'm just going to call it subsidy because I don't know what else to call it. Mm-hmm. That stays right there all the time. And then over time, does that have an effect on this scenario in smoothing any future impact as far as a rate increase or some sort of action? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. Okay. Yeah. And I think I can answer in two general ways. For purposes of this analysis, no, we didn't look at it that way. We didn't try to identify with the current subsidy the current amount that is a benefit from wholesale sales that is derived that helps offset our low retail rates. From a general standpoint, if we did have retail rate increases in the future, that would help preserve that same level of subsidy mm-hmm. into the future. And to the extent that we have rate increases, that improves our financial results and then provides less likelihood in a low probability challenging event that you would be forced to raise rates because you would be improving your financial results along the way. I do know that is also something that is being worked on in our finance group of trying to look at different ways of evaluating what the current spreads are between retail rates versus wholesale mm-hmm. costs. And I know that is something that is being worked on, but not for purposes of this analysis.
Well, I'm interested in that because we're looking at our debt and our mm-hmm. based on rates, and we're trying to use the rates as a way of looking at how much we should reduce our debt over time. There is a benefit to reduce debt as well that impacts our rates and what it costs.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe these two things together, I haven't seen that where you bring those two items together, the debt reduction and then also maybe some way of smoothing the rate impact over time. What would that look like, and how would that impact the rate payer? Because we talk about small increments over time.
Mm-hmm.
This way, we don't have to keep looking at it. We don't have to react to a situation. It's automatically mm-hmm. happening. The customer still gets a benefit. It doesn't change. It's the same, but it also follows the course of our financial picture as well. And I think actually puts a little more accountability on management in order to maintain costs and as you go through the
I know one of the challenging things is trying to plan to both the expected scenario and the stress scenario. And in the expected case, even continuing to reduce our debt and drive our debt leverage down, for financial metric purposes, there isn't a need to increase rates to continue to drive that debt leverage number down. It's only when we get into that low probability year-over-year challenge scenario.
Yeah. I'm looking at the brown line.
Yeah, exactly, the brown line. That's yeah. The challenge is if we're looking at the brown line, if we did factor in rate increases with the brown line, if we happen to end up in, and hopefully end up in, the blue line, the expected case scenario, there's the potential that we could actually have the result of a lot of liquidity, where we would drive our debt down, but we would be generating cash that we would then not necessarily have a way to apply that effectively. Mm-hmm. So there's that balance of, you know, which scenario do you plan to?
Just curious.
Yeah, I think instead of creating rate smoothing, you might create a rate yo-yo where, you know, in off-water years, sustained over a couple of years and expenses increasing, you increase your rates, could turn around with better water years and better prices, and then the expectation was you'd bring them back down. And so I just, you know, I'm not sure I'd want to, what index I'd want to attach a rate increase to.
I think the beauty of the tool the finance group has created is it allows us to explore some of these scenarios. And I think we could take that as a takeaway, that there's some work we do just in terms of thinking through the question of what a long-term rate strategy might be. I know it's one that came up during the strategic planning process mm-hmm. from the community, and it's one that we've been thinking that we need to get back to at some point anyway. It's just what is right. The philosophy of the board with respect to a long-term rate strategy. So I'd suggest that we just take this one away. I'd like to actually give these guys a little bit of a breather because they've worked really hard for quite a while, but a little bit of a breather to think about that some and then maybe bring something back to you in a few months. That's okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Gary.
I have a question on the 2019 debt reduction. What is the dollar figure on the bonds that are eligible for being called?
Let me see if I have that total here. 2019, it's about $60 million.
Perfect overlay, because in 2019 we begin our project.
We'd actually be pretty far into it by 2019, but it is a perfect overlay in terms of the amount that we're looking at for B1 through 4.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to point out that although the potential of not doing the 2019 debt reduction does not mean that we wouldn't continue to evaluate those for refinancing opportunities to reduce the interest cost on those. So they would still be candidates that we'd look at from a refinancing perspective, but maybe not something that we would actually use to pay off. So with all of our portfolio, if we're not actually paying the bonds off, we are continually looking for opportunities to refinance to reduce the cost on those as well. And those definitely would be a candidate for that.
Okay, so what I want to do is just gonna read this out loud. Our long-term debt philosophy, how we currently have it shaped, is to manage debt to create financial flexibility that supports low and stable electric rates, even if lower than expected financial results are experienced. And I just want to pause to confirm with the board, does this capture your vision from a long-term perspective?
Yeah.
Okay.
Covers mine.
Yeah.
Yep.
Great. Moving from the long-term debt philosophy, we also have the long-term planning strategies, and these were discussed in the last session. And these are how we would then translate that long-term debt philosophy into how we would incorporate into our planning and forecasting. And those currently are to maintain liquidity balance of greater than $175 million or the policy minimum as computed.
Can I ask a question there on the $175 million? It's been a while since we established that. I assume it's been revisited. So what is the primary criteria for establishing $175 million as our liquidity balance?
The liquidity methodology was defined as a way to capture what we believe are potential known items that we would need to cover, and so there's operational costs. So we include in our liquidity methodology a component of our O&M cost for about a 3-month O&M cost over time. It also includes some unplanned or variable items, some contingency type items, which includes a component for variations in our net wholesale revenues that may be at risk over time. So there's a component for that as well. There is also our enterprise risk management. We include a potential that there's some issues from an enterprise risk perspective, some contingencies of things that could happen. So those are all kinds of things that potentially could happen. And we want to include something in there, but they're not a known that will in fact occur. We've also included in the methodology a $2 million as an additional line item that we've actually added more recently to capture for some of the fire and weather-related risks associated with that. And those are all things we'll be talking with you and sharing some additional information in a later presentation. And then in addition to the operational component of the liquidity methodology and some of these contingents, we also have the planned part of the liquidity methodology, and that includes a component for the next year's debt service cost. It includes a portion of capital that we're anticipating that we're going to be having in the next year, so we include that as part of our computation. So it's a rather detailed evaluation that looks at a lot of different components to derive what is the amount that we anticipate that we're going to need. Mm-hmm. So that's the computed amount. The 175 as the minimum was established by looking at what those numbers actually come out to be as we've kind of looked at it historically and then also from a projected basis and what seems to make sense. The 175 also is somewhat in line with what the rating agencies look at as a strong AA credit of having, or AAA credit actually, is 250 days or more of cash, days cash. So this 175 is comparable to that. That will change, of course, depending upon what your expenditures are. But those are all factors that have come into the evaluation and the development of the liquidity methodology.
And in addition to that very comprehensive review, based on a question that Commissioner Bergeron asked a couple of meetings ago, we're developing a background paper for you that will come forward. We're tentatively planning it for the Q2 financial review, so we can go back through what the different elements are and how that $175 million and the alternative is calculated.
So for our long-term planning strategies, we would continue to target at least a greater of that 175 or the policy minimum. We would also target debt leverage of less than 35% by 2019 and then remain below 35% thereafter, preferably in the near term as financial results allow, driving that number down to the extent we can to minimize future risks. We would also intend to manage to our lowest net interest cost, which is the difference between our interest expense paid and our interest income generated.
Excuse me. What's sure. that number? What is that right now?
Ooh.
Ballpark.
15, 20 million
net?
Yeah.
Oh, is that high?
Is it lower than that now?
It's lower than that.
Well, we can get that. We can get that. We'll get that back to you. It's a lot less than it used to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually, we do look at the historical number quarterly. Mm-hmm. With a group in finance within the district, and it's amazing how much it's changed.
So the dollar number and the percentage number.
It would be a dollar number, a figure between the difference in interest costs we pay in each year versus the interest generated.
Which is around 4%, and what we earn is closer to what? 1%?
Our earnings are closer to 2%.
2%. Okay. That's helpful. Yeah.
We also have the difference between the debt portfolio, which is about $650 million, so that's at about a 4 to 5% cost versus a $350 to $400 million investment portfolio. So the size of the two portfolios also will have an impact on what that net difference is.
I see. Thank you.
We will send that information, though. And then, of course, as Debbie mentioned, that we are continually looking at refinancing opportunities. So where we can drive that down, we're always looking for options to do that. Again, for long-term planning strategies, we would continue to execute on the planned accelerated reductions through 2019 as long as liquidity allows. that would be something that if the board decides to move forward with the B1 through B4 recommendations, that would be where, as long as liquidity allows, comes into play. If we believe it's a better use of our resources to delay that planned acceleration rather than issuing new debt in that year or the year after, we would modify our retirement plans accordingly. We would also continue to plan pay-as-you-go, particularly for renewal and replacement capital, as long as liquidity allows, but certainly consider debt financing for more modernization expansion type capital when needed, trying to spread some of the costs of those longer-lived assets over time where appropriate. We would also intend to borrow for long-term sustainability, not temporary challenges. An example of that would be if we note in the quarterly update to the board that our liquidity is approaching that $175 million target or the policy minimum, but it's only approaching it for a very short period of time, for example, a one-year period. That would not necessarily be a case where we would immediately want to borrow. That would be a case where we would want the board to evaluate, consider, and then we would make a determination. So not temporary challenges, but long-term sustainability is what we're looking for. We'd also plan on doing debt financings in likely 2 to 3 year intervals to manage for cost efficiency and size. And then the toolbox available would include slowing cost growth, delaying discretionary capital, and modest electric rate increases over time as appropriate. And those would, of course, all be brought to the board for their consideration. Do these planning strategies, is this consistent with your vision and what you'd like to see from a planning and forecasting perspective? So as we take these long-term planning strategies, we incorporate them into our operational planning of finance, which is the how we meet all of these goals. Again, we split this into tiers of essentially detailed precision. The current year, this year is 2016 that we're working in, we have a high level of detail where we are right now doing our scheduled debt retirements with no early retirements, continuing pay-as-you-go capital and no new issuances planned for this year. And because we are not in a stress case this year, we don't have any stress mitigation tools, not because we don't have them available to us, but because we do not need them this year. Within the five-year planning forecast horizon, currently that's 2027 through 2020, we have a general path forward, which includes scheduled retirements and early retirements, currently 2017 through 2019. Moving forward with pay-as-you-go capital and no new issuances, and of course monitoring refinancing opportunities. Our first tools in a stress case or an accelerated capital cost scenario would be to scale back those early retirements. That's what we would be looking at in relation to this morning's presentation of Rock Island. And then beyond 2021 and forward, we'd be looking at a broad path, which would include scheduled retirements, but likely not any more early retirements. We'd be doing a mix of pay-as-you-go and new issuances to finance long-lived capital assets. And again, our stress mitigation tools include scaling back early retirements, decreasing growth, and also looking at incremental rate increases with plenty of planning time before we get to any of those points. So next steps from here, based on the board's feedback, and we'll get some additional information back to you. Our plan would be to come back in the fall of 2016 as part of the regular annual business planning process to communicate the operational plan of finance with specific 2017 budget assumptions and a revised general 2018 through 21 plan. Is there any additional questions I can answer at this time?
Great presentation.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yep, really thorough. Wow.
I think you've captured what we've been saying. Really do.
I'm very glad. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Could I just offer a thought that kind of pulls together the last two presentations? I think we've had a lot happen this year. From the start of the year, we've had cracks in head covers, cracks in bridge cranes, cracks in turbines at B1 through 4. It's a substantial amount of work that we really didn't know we had coming at us, a substantial amount of cost that we didn't know that we were going to have to address. Then in addition to that, I would say that we, coming out of strategic planning, we had thoughts about how we wanted to manage for both the expected value but also the low probability event, but we didn't really have a clear plan for what we would do in the stress case scenario. The thing that really comes together for me, and I have to say, is giving me a lot of comfort and just calming me from a fair amount of angst that I was feeling over the course of the last couple of months, is I think what we have now is a plan to address the problems that have occurred this year. Pretty clear plan. Certainly some challenges in terms of execution, but we know where we're going. And then an understanding of what the financial circumstances are for us, both in the expected value and the stress case, and the comfort that if the stress case were to show up, we have time to react to it, that it is not necessary to take action today with respect to rate increases or managing costs down. In fact, that would not be meeting the best for the most for the longest if we were to try to protect against those low probability scenarios. So that whole set of analyses that you've seen here today has taken a fair amount of angst that I was feeling and translated into, okay, now there's a bunch of work that we've got to do to go execute against this plan, but we know where we're going.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we have covered the morning agenda. It is 2 minutes until noon, so we probably don't want to try to squeeze anything more in. Let's recess and reconvene at 1 p.m. for a public hearing.
Got it on my phone. You want me to look?
Yeah. Yeah.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody to the afternoon business session of the Chelan Public Utility District. We met this morning in our study session. I'd like to welcome all our guests here, and we do welcome our input at our meetings, and we have a microphone up here at the table that if any member of the audience wishes to provide input, they come up to the microphone, state their name and address for the record, as these meetings are being recorded. All the regular commissioners are here today and would request that anybody that has their cell phone not in the silent or off position that you do silence it at this time. And I have a little note that I've written to myself here that I forgot to mention this morning, that today is a significant day in the life of one of the people in the room here today, fellow Commissioner Congdon, celebrating a birthday, and I will not ask which birthday, just that's off the table, but happy birthday, Ann.
You're not mentioning it because I think you're the same age.
Oh, maybe.
Are darn low.
No, Randy is younger, but we happen to graduate from high school the same age. So if you want to, same year. So if you want to know what year I graduated from high school and how old I am, we could get it as
check it out. Well, thank you for that. And I was going to pass on a happy summer solstice to everybody. And actually, we were just talking about it tonight. It's clearing up, which is wonderful. Look at the full moon. Apparently, it's called a strawberry moon because it's the first time in 50 years. I said 70, Kirk said 50, and I bet Kirk is right, that we've had a full moon on the summer solstice. So I don't know if it's going to be pink or if it's going to be especially large, but anyway, happy summer solstice.
All right,
everybody.
Yeah, very good. So as we reconvene our business, the first item on our business, actually we have two public hearings, the first one being public hearing on our integrated resource plan and resolution.
Hello, commissioners.
Good afternoon.
Third and final meeting. This is the legal hearing on the IRP.
I'm Becky Keening, Energy Planning and Trading. And so I wanted to just present to you quickly. Of course, we're asking for your approval of the IRP today, but wanted to present to you quickly the final draft load forecast that we have developed. I think we let you know last time we were going to come back with a edited load forecast. So that's what I'm going to do today, is share that with you first and then ask for your approval. So the update was to the HDL forecast that you knew we were still working on. And so the numbers over in the right-hand column in blue, that's what's changed, and that's all that's changed. And I believe in our last go-around, that 13 that you see And the low forecast was a 17, and the 30 UC in the base forecast was a 40, and the 44 UC in the high forecast was a 70. And so those have been lowered. The HDL low forecast has been lowered. And here's our updated chart, load forecast chart. And I want to give, and I need to mention, and this will be corrected in your final draft that I send out and that we put on the website. I want to give Charles credit this morning for catching something that no one else caught. The axis on the bottom was missing two dates. No data has changed, but from what you have in your packets and what is in the hard copy IRP I gave out to you, there's missing two dates. The lines are all the same in the graph and everything, but we'll get that fixed.
You want to get 14 and 15 back?
Yes. And we and up here on the screen, it is back. And then this is just this most recent load forecast, again, laid over the top of the district's net generation outlook for the IRP planning period through 2026. And that's all I have, except to ask for approval of the IRP.
So the resolution is...
should be the top on your
there it is.
Pile, okay, Commissioner.
Commissioners?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept Resolution 6 as presented.
Second.
It's moved and seconded that we approve Resolution 6, which is a resolution approving the district's 2016 Integrated Resource Plan. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And our second public hearing, staff has indicated that today for our high density load, they do not have any presentations, and the opportunity is being provided for us commissioners to ask any questions that we may have after we've had time to read the presentation that was made that we've received 2 weeks ago, and to also provide opportunity from any input from the public that may be forthcoming today, and that we will be recessing and continuing this hearing till our July 5 meeting after we have those questions answered and that input given. So, commissioners, any questions for staff?
So, Commissioner, if I might, before we take public comment, I would just say for the benefit of the board, those of that I haven't visited with, and the benefit of the public, that we do, staff does have some minor revisions to the staff report that we're currently in the process of making. They're not material or substantive changes to the report. They are, for the most part, grammatical and some additional comments in response to observations that have come since we provided it. Our intention is, we tried to have it for today, and that didn't work out with the number of people that need to review it and are participating in the effort, but our intention would be to have that to the board by email, probably from me in the next couple of days, and at the same time, for the benefit of the public, we will make it available on the web.
Thank you. Any comments from the public? If there are no comments or input from the public, we will recess and continue this hearing till 1 p.m. on our July 5 meeting here in the boardroom.
Thank you, Commissioner.
So done. Okay. Commissioners, we have a consent agenda.
I move approval of the consent agenda, Mr. Chairman.
I second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. On to our regular agenda and resolution number 10.
This is a proposed motion to approve district insurance policy renewal. And I'm going to have Ron Gibbs come up. And you've seen this one a couple of times now, so we're back to finish this one off hopefully.
Good afternoon. Ron Gibbs, Insurance and Claims Manager. And as Steve mentioned, just here to follow up from the meeting 2 weeks ago and to request a vote on a motion to approve this year's insurance renewal. So we will look at the quotes that we've received, the final quote, and review the not to exceed figure. And then you'll have an opportunity to consider a not to exceed dollar amount for the motion. Quick review, saved another $10,000 this year in negotiations from our last meeting. So we're down 8.5% compared to last year, down to just about $1.3 million property insurance. So 8.5% decrease. We were able to leverage some market conditions to our benefit. And then on the general liability side, we had an increase of 2% from $802,000 up to $818,000. So I always like to show this slide to get some historical perspective. And just as a reminder, we had this pretty large bump back in 2014 following the large unit losses at Rocky Reach. So you've seen the slide from 2 weeks ago. We've just revised the numbers. We're down now to $2,239,000. And this is a 4.5% decrease compared to last year. Typically, we would say we could continue negotiations, but I think these numbers are pretty solid at this point. I don't expect them to go down any further. So this is the proposed motion. We made it for $2,245,000, and as we do every year, we leave just a little bit of a cushion. Sometimes insurance companies come in with last-minute coverage options that might cost a little bit more to take an option. We just had one come through for cyber liability as well that we chose not to go forward with. But those, for example, those things do happen.
And commissioners, I would just say, in case you're inclined, the motion need not start until about halfway through the box.
You're right. 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 Thanks,
Eric. You could repeat staff's recommendation if you'd like.
Good point.
So, Mr. Chairman, I move that the commission authorize expenditures by the district not to exceed $2,245,000. Plus surplus line taxes and fees for the purchase of district insurance for July 1, 2016, 2017 policies upon terms and conditions approved by the general manager.
Second.
Been moved and seconded to approve the motion regarding our district insurance policies. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
Next up, I'd like to invite Court Hill up. We've got two projects, actually, that are closing out. So first is number 11, a resolution ratifying field work order change orders number 1 and 2, authorizing final acceptance of work performed under bid number 15-04 with Halm Builders of Davenport, Washington, and authorizing release of the bond in lieu of retainage. I'm going to go ahead and read the second one as well, resolution 12. Resolution ratifying field work order change order number 1, authorizing final acceptance of work performed under bid number 15-69, Nepal Electric and Controls, LLC of Moses Lake, Washington, and authorizing payment of retainage. So with that, I'm going to turn over to Court.
All right, Court Hill, project manager here at the district. So the first resolution is for board acceptance of work performed under contract 15-04. This is the Daroga State Park Group Camp Improvements. This work was performed as part of our Rocky Reach license implementation and involved building of a new restroom and 7 RV pedestals in the parking lot to support the group camp. The construction of the restroom also included building of a septic drain filled system. And on the screen here is a before picture and after picture. So as you can see, the facility looks a lot like what we have out there now.
We hope so.
And I assume you're referring to the one in the middle, not the smaller one to the right.
Yes.
The one on the right is really spending. That's the case.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure what the one on the right is doing there.
Okay.
So a few lessons learned with this project I'd like to share with the board. As-built utility drawings from original park construction are not always precise. Locating underground utilities during design is sometimes necessary to avoid costly delays and additional work, which we discovered on this job. A second lesson learned on a previous park project was that we should always award bids to general contractors specializing in building construction, even when a bid includes a significant amount of utility work, such as this job had a drain filled associated with it. This bid was awarded to a general contractor who specializes in building construction, and the finished product was exceptional, and it helps to reinforce that we've learned a lesson. The last lesson learned on this project is regards to stakeholder engagement. Our contractor operator is our primary stakeholder, State Parks, and we spent a significant amount of time during design development reviewing the design with them, and we ended up with a project that they're very happy with, very satisfied. So they're willing to support and maintain, operate for us. Any questions about this resolution?
Thank you.
I have a question. So this was remodeling, not new construction building. For the restroom.
This was actually new. Yeah. So before, this is the before picture, and then we built a new restroom at the location. So,
and the cost of just building that facility.
The cost was, the original bid was $740,000 bid price.
Right.
And then we had about $10,000 in field work order change order.
Thank you.
So about $750,000. Yeah, so the
cost is amazing to me. Wrapping my head around the cost of structures like that.
Yeah, one of the big components of that cost was the septic drain filled. So it's a fairly sizable drain filled. And we also had 7 RV pedestals. So these are spread out through the parking lot. So what you don't see on the screen are those 7 RV pedestals, and then of course the septic drain filled's all underground. So
if you were to just assess the cost for the structure of the building,
it would probably be about less than $600,000, but
still a
$500,000. But still, these buildings are not cheap.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Very good.
There's no further questions on that one. We'll go to the second resolution. Which was also a park project. It was at our BB Bridge Park, and this was contract 15-69. This project involved upgrading our RV pedestals from a 30-amp to a 50-amp. Work necessitated upsizing the electrical system, which includes transformers, panels, conductors, raceway. Most of the work is underground, with the exclusion of the pedestal itself, which not real exciting, so I don't have any before and after pictures for you. But the project is complete. That resolved a problem that we have with electrical demand shortage, which was a fairly significant camper dissatisfaction, and also caused some electrical safety issues. So this was a project that we had planned for several years, and we've actually completed similar upgrades as part of our Rocky Reach license implementation at Lincoln Rock and Daroga. When we rebuilt ENIAP Park, we also put in 50-amp pedestals there. So this is an ongoing need as a result of these larger RV vehicles that are coming into our park.
Mm-hmm. Speaks to our evolving tourist nature.
So I also have some lessons learned to share on this project. Because this was the third 50-amp project that we've upgraded project that we've done the last 3 years, we've learned quite a bit. So we've applied some of those lessons learned from previous projects, which included holding a pre-bid meeting in the office and on-site, performing as much work as possible when the park was closed. This work was started in February and completed about the first week of April, and was done in really quick order, very efficiently performed by a contractor who knew that campers were coming into the park. So very well executed. We also spent time during the design process evaluating what existing conductor was in the ground and how much of that we could reuse rather than digging new conductor. So we make as much carry as much efficiency as we can into the project so we can avoid some of the additional construction work that's unnecessary. So there's two camp loops out there, loop one and loop two. And loop two, we were actually able to complete without putting in any new conduit. We were able to reuse all the existing conduit and just pull out the old wire and pull in the new wire. So that's an example of the efficiencies we had on the project.
Probably saves on asphalt too.
Yes, definitely. So this project went very smoothly. Hardly, we had one small field work order change order that was a CT that needed replaced at the request of Douglas PUD. So, are there any questions?
You just prompted a question. We are now a customer of Douglas PUD there.
Yes.
It's different. Commissioner Congdon.
Yeah, Court, I was, you actually answered a question I was going to ask you. I was going to say, do you see value in, from your end, do you see value in these lessons learned? And you just expressed that you really do. I mean, we as commissioners, I think it's interesting to hear, and I know our public likes hearing it, mm-hmm. but there's real value, it sounds like.
Yes, for you. I think we've been had the opportunity to do them for a few years now that we're able to show you how that we've captured on those mm-hmm. lessons learned. So there's some return on value there. Mm-hmm. So hopefully you're seeing that.
Yeah, good. That's good.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next up is 13, a resolution selecting and authorizing implementation of the 2016 and 2017 public power benefit program options and related budget items. We're going to welcome Kelly Boyd back, who's been gone for a week. Maybe, Kelly, I'll just take a second just to make sure that this hopefully goes smoothly, just to capture what happened in the week that you were gone. The purpose here is we're going to bring back to you the resolution that was brought forward to the board the last time, with the exception of the camping proposal, because as we understood it, there was not concern about the other pieces of this, and it would allow us to move forward with confidence in the other areas. And then later, under a manager's item, I'm going to bring back up the issue of the camping proposal and just provide you some additional information about that for your consideration. So, Kelly, I hope I didn't completely steal your thunder, but I also wanted to make sure that we got it captured right relative to the conversations we've had with the board.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate that, and I can scratch off most of my talking points I have here. But I am here this afternoon with the revised resolution, and it allocates the 2016 Public Power Benefit Program funding for selected projects that are detailed in Exhibit A, and then it also approves the related budget revision for those 2016 selected projects where we had the total amount designated, but as we select specific projects, we then allocate that funding accordingly to where those projects are selected. And then the third element of the resolution is establishing the initial program amount for 2017, the up to $4 million amount, and it designates two initial projects for 2017, also detailed in Exhibit A. And those projects will be incorporated into the 2017 budget process. The selected options are the result of the public sessions held on March 21st, April 21st, May 2nd, and May 16th. And another board session is anticipated in the October timeframe for the board to consider further allocations based on study results of some of the selections were to study specific options, so we would anticipate another session later in the year for further consideration. So with that, are there any further questions?
Questions? Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
Okay, for item 14, I'm going to read the resolution, but we had the presentation this morning, so we're not planning to do an additional presentation this afternoon. This is a resolution establishing a new capital project for 2016 for Rock Island Powerhouse 1 through. That's not written right. Try that again. For Rock Island Powerhouse B1 through B4 modernization, approving development of project specifications and proposed bid documents, and approving proposed workforce changes. So I didn't think we were going to do a presentation, but I see Kirk and Fred here.
We're not. We just came up in case there were questions.
Okay.
Are there any questions? We had a great presentation this morning. No questions?
Good.
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Commissioners, we have four resolutions before us, resolutions 11 through 14. What is your desire?
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of resolutions 11 through 14.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve resolutions 11 through 14. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. We are now down to manager items.
Okay, let's start with the external events. What are you doing that for us?
Good afternoon, communications. Good afternoon, commissioners. Kimberly Craig from Communications. Just wanted to give you a couple heads up on community events that are coming up. First of all, I want to let you know that this week is the first ever STEM, Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math Hydropower Event Academy at Rocky Reach Dam. This is being presented by the Foundation for Water and Energy Education, of which all the three MIDPUDs are members, and other utilities around the Northwest. It's bringing 16 high school students from around the Northwest to Rocky Reach Dam for 5 days of learning with the idea of finding out how cool career opportunities are in hydropower, and being capped with a graduation ceremony on Friday. The students who complete the week-long academy will receive one college credit for their work.
Cool.
And again, it's also a chance for FWE to evaluate the program, look for improvements, and we hope the academy will continue. Also want to remind you about the 4th of July festivities that will be taking part on July 4th in Walla Walla Point Park. Of course, Chelan PUD's Parks Department provides tremendous support to that event, And there's live music throughout the day, and then a wonderful live Wenatchee Valley Symphony performance along with the fireworks. So if you're anywhere in the valley at all, look up to the skies about 9:45 and tune in to Coho Radio, and you can hear the music live if you're not close enough to hear it. And then also, Commissioner Bowles asked me to share with you, we received a nice award from Washington Elementary School from their STEAM education program, which is Science, Technology, Engineering, Art, and Math, for general support over the years from Chelan PUD, from everything from folks coming there, parents, volunteers to talk about hydropower and line operations and safety and stewardship and critters and pelts and all kinds of things over the years. And this is a really active program. Sarah Rolfs, who we've been involved with in other community activities here, is one of the standard bearer parents that are involved. And also a great thanks from Principal Keith Collins, who thanked Chelan PUD. And Sarah, I heard, selected Commissioner Bowles to accept the award because there's a third grader with a close relationship with her grandfather at on the PUD commissioner and so commission, so he was happy to be there. Anyway, thank you very much. We also had an extremely successful event at the Apple Sox, PUD Night at the Apple Sox on Friday, and we'll be sending you some pictures and telling you a little bit more about that.
Quick question. The college credit being offered to that the STEM, what university is that through?
It will be through WVC, but it is a transferable credit. So college president Jim Richardson will be there on Friday to present the credits to the students.
That's super. Yeah.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
A few other things. The community-sponsored effort called Our Valley, What's Next? Has been continuing its efforts to try to put together a strategic plan for the Valley. And I attended a meeting about a week and a half ago where they've taken the efforts from the community and translated those into action items. And the action items are then being allocated out to what are called lead partners, entities within the community who potentially could take a lead in implementing the action. So I've received that information and shared with you all a response back. There's some things that fit with what we're doing, some that need to be modified. That's what they were actually looking for. They asked for that kind of input. Comments are due by Thursday of this week. And so I've heard from a couple of you already, I know, but just wanted to check in because I'd be responding on behalf of the PUD. So if you have thoughts about that draft, it'd be helpful to get them back, even if possible today or tomorrow. Wanted to bring up to date that we had Suzanne Grissel in Washington, D.C. last week talking about the hydropower relicensing conditions that are included in the Senate energy bill that has passed and is now moving towards conference with the House, and particularly talking about our early action credit language. And it was great to see. You all know Suzanne is a real talent and a treasure for us here at the district to see her being recognized in that way as someone who was representing National Hydropower Association and a panel on the Hill, and then actually able to move forward with some of our issues, including some conversations with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission staff. And so we continue to be hopeful of both a legislative or administrative approach to addressing our concerns. And then finally, so we have done a bit more work, and I'll apologize for the use of the term feasibility study in the past with respect to the camping pilot program, because feasibility study, I think, connotes something more like an engineering study, and that's not really our intent with this. So what we've done is some program design work on the camping study, just to take a look at what it would take to implement a camping pass pilot program. And I'm going to hand out something that, that describes this. The basic conclusion is we've looked at this in terms of if we were running a pilot program, we'd try to run it as efficiently as possible. The costs of offering free camping, if we were to do 5 sites, which is the suggestion at least out of the 46 sites that we have, would be somewhere between $19,000 to $30,000. $30,000 would be if every site would have been occupied during the entire camping season by a paid camper and is substituted for someone who is camping for free. We think that it's unlikely that the sites are full all the time, or that there would be free campers there that would be taking their place all the time. So probably something more in the closer to the $20,000 range is our expectation of the cost. And then in terms of administration, we've tried to think this through in terms of what's the simplest way we could do it, which would be currently we do offer the parking pass for the state parks. So we would put something on the back of that. So if you're getting a parking pass for the state parks, you would then get the ability to do a camping pass. And it would be something like our folks who would be managing it would punch a hole and to indicate whether they had used one night of free camping, and you'd get up to 3 nights of free camping. So it doesn't cost us more in terms of developing the mechanism of actually providing the pass. And the way it would be implemented is on a first-come, first-served basis. Currently, we don't have reservations out there at BB Park anyway, so the free camping would be handled the same as the paid camping. And that also reduces the cost. So we think we could probably administer for this for something in the range of about $10,000 or so.
Can I just stop in here? I mean, yeah, punch card's one thing. Why not just a coupon or something like that that you just turn in?
We were trying to make it as cost-efficient as possible since we're already producing this this pass. That's the way we thought about it. Actually, if it turned out that suggestion was cheaper, we still could.
Yeah.
We really have not candidly spent a lot of time on this.
It just occurred to me that way you can just turn it down.
It'd be an option that'd be available to us. So as we said before, this is not something staff is making a recommendation on. This is one for the commission to decide. But we wanted to give you a sense of what we thought it would cost if we were to choose to go down this path. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to you all.
Commissioners, what are your thoughts?
In terms of what? What are we doing today on this?
Whatever. That is your choice, what you do today. Our choice, I should say.
So, I asked this question before, and you probably answered it, but I don't remember. What was the genesis of the free camping at the park? Did that come from the topic team, the park topic team? Is Michelle here?
I think it came from the commission. I think it was an idea from Commissioner Arthur.
So it wasn't a high interest item from the topic team. I didn't see it. I didn't see it there.
The topic team actually reviewed that. I don't remember.
Good afternoon, Michelle Smith, manager of Hydro Licensing. The camping idea did come up during the original input that we got from all the residents on for ideas. However, it did not rise to the top 10 originally. I think it was when we were talking about the parking pass, it kind of got brought into that. But the camping idea was something that was in the original idea list. It just did not rise to the top 10 at the time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'd like to move that we implement a pilot project in 2017 in order to waive camping fees on 5 campsites at BB Bridge Campground. Furthermore, I would move that this program be combined with the parking pass program for ease of implementation.
I'll second that.
So, commissioners, they moved and seconded to implement the camping pass pilot study, and that it be combined with the day pass for ease of implementation.
So we're open for discussion.
Yes, we are.
Right. So I will preface this with saying that Gary and I think you all know Gary's been really in favor of this, and I've really had a lot of reservations. So we had a good discussion this morning, and he explained to me his feelings about this and why he feels really strongly about it. And then I explained to him why I really have reservations. So we're that's where we are. We understand each other. Philosophically, I cannot support this. I would never support this. I don't think that in any way, shape, or form it follows our overarching, you know, theme of the best for the most for the longest. And I really feel like, you know, like I support the free parking. I understand that because our customers think of the parks as their parks. And to have to pay for parking in their own parks, I understand. I understand that they don't want to have to pay for parking, and I support that, and I agree with it. But then to take the next leap to now providing free camping, I mean, I think there's a reason why the state parks didn't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole. I mean, I think it's fraught with all kinds of difficulties. But more than the specifics, and the other thing I feel like is that we're, you know, really we are supposed to be providing low-cost, reliable power. That's our core business to the PUD. And I feel like we're moving along the spectrum way down towards social engineering when we begin to take money and put it toward providing free camping for folks who can't afford to pay for camping. Now, I absolutely support our Helping Hand program, which helps customers who can't pay their power bill. We don't want to turn their power off in the middle of winter. I pay into that every month with my bill. I support that 100%, but I absolutely philosophically can't support the free camping. Okay. I can't justify it to my constituents, to the people. I've had people say to me, and I will tell you, these are some of the things I've heard. One person said to me, well, so what are you guys going to do next? Offer free ski passes at Mission Ridge? Well, I mean, obviously that's a leap. I've had people really question the idea that we even build cabins in the parks. Competing, as I said before, they question competing with private industry. So, you know, it's not something that I can support and explain and justify to the ratepayers I talk to. I think it just doesn't work for me.
Okay. Additional input.
I'll just weigh in here. I seconded the amendment because, you know, what this is just a pilot study. It doesn't mean that we have to continue with this on forever. I'm interested to see how popular something like this would be. I understand what Commissioner Congdon is talking about. This kind of issue for any one of these public power benefit programs can be her issue can be brought up every time, the way I can see it, because it's the debate of the best, the most, for the longest. We all look at that a little differently, and I think what she says supports my first concern about having a framework of some sort that the commission can analyze and look at these proposals on a case-by-case basis. That, you know, we've talked about it, having a framework where we can plug and play different things in it depending on the community, depending on the situation. So this is just an initial. This is where we're going to go with this, unless we have a way of measuring each one of these proposals as a commission. So I'd like to see the study. I'd like to see the results of it. I'd like to see if there's interest in it, and I'd also like to see if the public likes it. And we're always going to find somebody that doesn't like something, no matter what we do. So let's just, it's not a lot of money. It's a drop in a bucket. It doesn't make any difference one way or the other, whether we do it or not financially to this utility. So let's see how it goes. So I support it.
And I just, you know, and I'm going to take a little bit different tact on it. We, you know, we provide public parks and literally millions of dollars invested in fields. And we have select soccer teams that come from Bellevue that we never charge a dime to use that, but yet we'll turn around and charge our own people to use our campsites. And I just find that pretty ironic.
Well, I think it's probably before we vote appropriate for all of us to make our comments and our thoughts. I think you all heard my concern last time and my concern that maybe I was the one that misinterpreted what a pilot study was versus a feasibility study. And I don't know that I don't think I have moved in terms of my willingness to vote for this at this moment in time, so I will oppose it at this moment in time, not for the same reasons that Commissioner Congdon is opposing it, but because we have such a large group of studies ongoing that we don't know what's going to come back to us. We don't know what our full plate of options truly is at this moment in time. And I really have that concern that once you ring the bell of free camping, it's going to be very difficult to unring it if we choose to decide to unring it. And so I think it's premature. And so from that standpoint, I'll be opposing the motion. So there is a motion and a second on the floor. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
Nay.
Nay. So the motion passes 3-2. Let's see how it goes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that is it for manager items.
All right. We're going down to commission items. Let's start with Carmen. Go that way.
Okay. Okay, so looking back a little ways from our last commission meeting, the following day on Tuesday, I did attend a candidate orientation conference that we had here in the district, right here in the boardroom, where the other candidates for PUD commissioner came in. We sat. I think the district, the staff did a very good job in proposing presenting, you know, their part of the utility. I thought it was very informative, a lot of information. Feedback I got from one of the candidates was, well, it's a lot, and it is a lot to get your head around with. But, you got to start somewhere, and I think it was a very open process. First one I've ever attended, and I liked it, and I thought it was a good thing. So. That's my feedback on it, and I think, you know, off to the races we go, right? So the other things I did was on the 15th, I did meet with Steve again on a morning meeting as usual, or biweekly. And in addition, I did meet with Commissioner Arsenal later on. I can't remember what the date that was, Gary, but we met and talked about you know, a one-on-one, and we, you know, Gary, I came away with that with, I thought that was really good. You know, this is something that that I don't think we've done as a commission, had one-on-ones of that nature. Periodically we do, but for me it was fairly new, and I thought that was it gives you a chance to get down. It helps Gary. He's fairly new in this thing, and he gets to pick my brain a little bit, and I get to see where he's coming from. And I think it helps us have a better understanding as a commission if we can have that kind of one-on-one conversation. We used to have, we talked about that a little bit when we had weekly meetings, and we had much more touches between commissioner during that time, because every Monday you'd be here and you'd have that chance to talk and get to know each other a lot better. I've felt ever since we made that decision to move to biweekly meetings, we left something. We lost a little bit of something. Now, the staff gained because you got a lot more time, and I appreciate that. but yet, you know, it was very important for the commission in itself to have a relationship, and I think we work much smoother when we do. And so I've just thought that maybe if we can reach out a little bit that as commissioners, do a little bit more of that one-on-ones, and it doesn't have to be about business either. I think we work better as a commission. So, anyway, that's a little bit of feedback. Moving forward, on the 23rd, I'll be meeting with Eric and having our bi-weeklies or bi-monthlies, or monthlies, I guess it's monthlies. And then on the 28th, we'll have a quarterly audit committee meeting. And the same night, we'll be going to the Leavenworth substation community meeting as well, followed by the next day with another meeting with Steve on Wednesday morning. So that's what I've got going.
Okay. Dennis.
Yeah, just kind of going back and reviewing. We had a regular business meeting on June 6th. Spent the time on KPQ radio, but on the 7th, had the opportunity to represent this organization for the STEAM Award at Washington Elementary on the 9th, and met with Steve on Tuesday the 14th. With Gary Arsenault at Northern Starbucks last Friday, and with Steve Saturday at the same location, same table. It's getting to be habitual. looking forward to our meetings today, and then the meeting with Eric on the 22nd. That will be scarce for a few days because we have the opportunity to take 3 of our 5 grandkids to the Oregon coast and Mariners games and some other kinds of things. So it's always great to be a grandpa. Thank you.
Gary, you haven't done anything, right?
No. Back on the 7th of June, I had the opportunity to meet with Steve for our monthly check-in. And then on the 10th, flew out along with Commissioner Smith to the American Public Power Association National Conference in very chilly, kind of cold with Phoenix.
Cool.
I don't care if it's dry heat. It's still hot.
I think you're probably sitting by that air conditioner.
Oh, cool. Man.
105 is 105.
Yeah, you just couldn't cool down that hotel room enough. And this was my first American Public Power Conference. I have to admit, this is a very well-done conference. A lot of energy has been put into preparing these conferences. The exchange of information is very valuable. The opportunity to meet other individuals in the power industry is invaluable, especially for a relatively new commissioner like myself. I get to the flavor of the various types of energy generation across the United States, and it's vast. Also meeting one of our sessions where we met sponsors, having a chance to talk with folks from Moody's, having a chance to talk to the folks from S&P. Very, very interesting, very intriguing, and very informative for a new commissioner like myself. So that was a very good experience for me. I came away learning a great deal. As I look forward, I look into my meeting next Monday, 1 week from today. I'll be having a meeting with Commissioner Ron Walter and Commissioner Don Etherington, as I do every month, to chat about issues that affect the county. Then on the 28th, I have a meeting scheduled with Eric. We'll be talking over some issues, and Eric is always giving good legal guidance and vision into things going on here at the district. And then the evening of the 28th, we have the Leavenworth Substation community meeting, which I plan to attend. That's it.
You've answered one question. Yeah. We need to establish a special meeting, but we'll get to that.
Yeah.
So the only thing I have to add to the list that you've heard, I will be attending the 23rd, on the 23rd, Washington PUD Association Quarterly Water Committee meeting. I have a Building Council of North Central Washington meeting I'm going to be attending, and all of the above, all the other things that have been mentioned. So that's all I have.
All right. Well, looking back, it's the last 2 weeks have been really busy. And that's always a good thing. And that doesn't even count cherry harvest. So following our June 6th meeting, I was on the radio with Coho and Cozy on the 7th. Then I actually flew into Phoenix for the APPA National Conference a day earlier than Gary, with a specific reason in mind. American Public Power, before every national conference for the last 10 years, has put together what they call a day of giving. And on Friday the 10th, my wife and I spent all day packaging meals for the starving kids in that particular day in the country of Belize. And we and about 120 other individuals packaged over 43,000 meals on that day. And it was, while it was a lot of work, it was a lot of fun. I just got to say, you get to know fellow policymakers and utility managers from all over the United States in that capacity, and all of you have share this common bond of spreading the good beyond your own local community, and it was a lot of fun. I would say I echo Gary's comments on the value of the conference. There's so many great presentations that it would be hard to identify any one of them. But sometimes the interesting twist, and this is not utility associated at all, comes when you least expect it. And for me, the one that I least expected is when I got in the cab to go to the airport with Commissioner Arsenault and my wife. The taxi driver strikes up a conversation with us and talks about being found out we were from Washington. He said he grew up with Marshawn Lynch, the Seattle Seahawk. And a little additional conversation about the work that he's doing in Haiti. And Gary, I knew, had done a lot of projects in Haiti, and my brother lived there for 20 years. And so that to have this author with his, probably not a bestseller, but was in his glove box, the book that he had written, sharing all of this with us, I thought, wow, what an incredible world we live in. It's a small world, but it's a neat world. So anyway, it was a great conference. I got a lot out of it. I still encourage all of my fellow commissioners to, whenever you have that opportunity, to take that time, because the keynote speakers and the breakout sessions, breakout session on drone usage, and I understand there's some chatter about drone development around here, which is cool. And so, you know, just a wide array of topics that we cover. Looking forward, either tomorrow or next week, and yet to be determined, I will have my biweekly meeting with Steve. We've got a back-to-back, and we're going to change that before we get out of here today. We do have, I have, on Wednesday morning, Cashmere Economic Development meeting, and I'm representing the PUD at that meeting, was asked to be a part of that, and so we'll be doing that. We do have a couple of meetings that Carnan and I both will be attending the following week that I don't think he got on his the 28th. I believe we have an audit committee meeting.
He mentioned it.
Yep. You did mention it. And then on July 1st, which is Friday, I think he didn't mention this one because he has to buy breakfast.
I knew there was a reason it wasn't in my
And so we've got that, and July 1, Friday. Yeah, Friday, July 1. And then I also believe I have, actually tomorrow, my monthly with Eric. So that's my, you know, it's been a busy past 2 weeks, got a lot of brief meetings, and I'm going to the substation meeting in Leavenworth on the, that's the 28th?
28th.
Yeah. So anyway, that's mine. Is that a motion?
It is. And just for the record, it says it's from me, but it's really from Sheila.
Since I did hear in our go-around that there's going to be three of us attending that, we will need to set a special meeting at Leavenworth City Hall, 6 p.m. on June 28th.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we set a special meeting for June 28th, 2016 at 6 p.m. at Leavenworth City Hall, located at 700 U.S. 2 Highway, U.S. 2, Leavenworth, Washington, for the purpose of discussing the proposed Leavenworth substation siting.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to set a special meeting on June 28th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. All right. Follow-up.
We had four items from the last meeting. The first had to do with the high density load possibility of an effective date of January 1, 2017. We've just carried that away and said that's an option for us that we can discuss when we get to the point of actually adopting the rate. There's nothing that would preclude us from doing that. A few I would call minor policy ramifications that we can talk through when we get to that point. The long-term debt, you had asked for an example scenario of reducing the capital plan. We saw that in Heather and Debbie's presentation today. We were supposed to come back to you on the BB Bridge camping program issue. You've seen that here today. And then cybersecurity, there's a request that we get back to you on an overview of all the things going on cybersecurity. And candidly, that's such a big request that it's going to take us a couple of months to put that together. We have created a internal senior level team that is working on cybersecurity issues, and it's been a challenge for us to just get our arms around all the different initiatives that are coming at us, particularly from the national level, but also at the state level. So we have that on our to-do list, and it'll be sometime this summer that we'll get back to you.
Okay. Right. And from this meeting, delegation?
I've got two identified. One is some additional information following up on the long-term debt philosophy scenarios to look at rate strategy options, just some different ways that we might choose to manage rates and what the impact would be on the overall financial condition of the utility. So I would expect that will probably be a couple of months as well. Might put that together in terms of some background information for the board workshop. And then the second one is the request for the lowest net interest cost. So I expect that we should be able to get that to you by email in not too distant future.
Not the lowest, right? Just the
current.
What's current. The net interest cost?
Current.
Is.
Current.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's that. Thank you. That's right.
Okay.
Did I miss anything?
I don't think so. No. Okay. So, is there additional public comment? Any other matters to come before the commission before we go into executive session? Length of the executive session?
I'm just going to ask for 45 minutes because, once again, it'll depend on how many questions you have. It could be much shorter, though.
Okay. So in that case, we will, after a short recess, move into executive session till approximately 2:45 for the purpose of discussing legal, council, agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCW. All right. We're coming out of executive session. This is Chelan PUD Commission on June 20th, 2016. It's approximately 2:44 p.m. Coming out of executive session, no votes were taken, no decisions were made. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we stand adjourned. Stand adjourned. Stand adjourned. Stand adjourned.